this very important meeting after a long, short weekend. We have received apologies from Honorable Greg. He'll be joining us. He's stuck in traffic on the road. And from there, I know what it means. ANG is seeing a doctor, but he will be joining us all day to come. Reverend Nishwe requested to leave after 11. We understand he's the leader of the party, and we appreciate that he prioritized our meeting. We also want to warmly welcome amongst us Mr. Chris Aslan. He is a DNA specialist. I understand he is visiting South Africa from Britain. And we do appreciate his presence here. And of course, he is going to brief us on few things on DNA. And we are indeed finalizing one of the important pieces of legislation in this country, which is the Criminal Law Forensic Procedures Amendment Bill. We split it into fingerprints, body prints, and photo images, both yes, photographic images. And we agreed that after this, we'll then engage in the processing of the DNA aspect of the bill. But we are happy that he is here. I hope we are not going to be long, because I think a lot of work was done last week. But we will allow Commissioner Jacobs to lead us using the document that was distributed to members last week, because I think that is where they've made comments. Safe to mention that the chairperson phoned him to say add a stroke, remove a stroke there, and so on and so forth. But I think it will be proper that we use that document, whatever that we might have removed or added or he explained to the chairperson. I think it is good that the members also benefit from that explanation. I definitely will not delay because our meeting starts at 10. I will therefore hand over to Commissioner Jacobs to present a clean bill, and then members will comment. Mr. Jacobs.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, the copy link is the one that was distributed. I will point out that the issues that was raised on the meeting. Madam Chair, what we have done as well is to align the object memorandum to the bill that is already presented as well, just to round off the issue. Madam Chair, I'm going to start with the amendments that was made to the in the long title of the bill on page 2, I'm seeing a report that there was the insertion of the first line of fingerprints. The of was for the retention of fingerprints, and then just the next line inserted the word further. Madam Chair, and then important, there was a line that said that to effect alignment with the child that regarding the placement of fingerprints and body prints of the child. Now, there is a provision in the Child Justice Act on the placement of fingerprints. So our proposal was, and we deleted here that reference, because it's not an alignment. Although in the Act, we did make provision for the placement of fingerprints of the child. country on the first screen, there was nothing sent on the document. On page 4, we have aligned the wording of authorized person with what was discussed in the committee, was deviated. And then we have inserted a new definition, that is the definition of the Child Justice Act. That I'm saying the final copy, we will just bold Child Justice Act. And then the definition of comparative search. Madam Chair, we have streamlined that definition. In this wording here, the last three lines, irrespective of whether the fingerprints, body prints, or photographic images stored on the database were predicted before or after the commencement of this section. Madam Chair, according to our discussion this weekend and recommendation from your Honor, we actually say that part can also be deleted from the definition because it's related to the database, and what is really an issue here is the comparing of fingerprints. So we propose that we can just delete the last three lines of that definition, and of course we need to read chapter 5A of the South African Judicial Act, semicolon, and then we just delete the last three lines. And here then, on page 4 as well, subsection 2 that is inserted, and here the discussion was and the committee decided that we should not address the issue of taking of fingerprints by means of regulations either in the South African Police Service Act or in the Criminal Procedure Act. So what we have inserted here is a substantive provision, and it's actually broader than just the Criminal Procedure Act. It reads any police official who, in terms of this act or any other act, other law, takes the fingerprints, body prints, or a certain any body feature of a child, must have due regard to the personal rights relating to privacy, dignity, and body integrity of the child, do so in a private area, not in view of the public, see where reasonably practical will ensure the presence of a parent or guardian of a child or a personal worker, and D, treat and address the child in a manner that takes into account mutual hurt, anger, and
yes, members, I want us to start from the long definition. Is there anything the commissioner is saying? They are proposing that we remove the alignment with the Child Justice Act because there isn't any way in this in the Child Justice Act where this thing is covered. So it's not in the alignment, and are we in agreement? It would seem like we are, there is no objection, and therefore we take this definition as it is without the alignment.
Can I just, just at the top of page 3, at the top of page 3 it says, to amend yada yada yada, powers in respect of fingerprints or body prints for investigation. Should that not be criminal investigation? Because that's a very open-ended term. In other words, investigation could be, let's do a credit check, let's do a bank may ask, someone may. There are many reasons to do an investigation, so I don't know that this must be more specific as to what kind of investigation.
Madam Chair, as a matter of fact, in the body of the bill itself, it's made very clear for which purposes fingerprints may be taken, may be stored, and may be used. And those are set out very clear, and even an offence, if you use it for any other purpose. Okay.
Kevin, the sound system is not working.
The attention is that it will abuse the misuse of information or fingerprint information.
So it's clear enough, we leave it like that. And therefore, page 3, we don't have any problem, we can proceed to page 4. Page 4, there is a proposal that the comparative search definition should go as far as South African Police Service Act, and therefore means the comparing of fingerprints, body prints, or photographic images taken under any power conferred by this chapter by an authorized person against any database referred to in Chapter 5A of the South African Police Service Act, finish. We leave out those three lines. Are we in agreement with that definition? I personally thought it.
I just want to take you that one else we said about that. When we talk about bodily prints and when we talk about distinguished features, that it comes out strong enough that it should be done by the fingerprint of the dog. I'm not worried about the fingerprint part of it, but the bodily part and the distinguished features.
That not referred to later. Maybe, yeah.
And I think that could be the purpose of the speak and address itself in a manner affecting the current people of both gender and age. Excuse me. On page 5.
So we are in agreement with that definition of comparative search up to Police Service Act.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore we are taking that and as such the strokes that are their fingerprints, they no longer count. Okay?
Yeah, sorry. The station says, and I don't think it's actually the, it takes into account their gender or age. It doesn't say, think of someone who's working in a police station in a rural area, and say, okay, I've noted it's a boy and it's this age. Right, ladies, come and do the bit. There has to be an instruction that anything to do with the child is by people of the same gender. That would be my take on it.
Are we already on page 5?
No. Well, it's just he referred to the one on the page.
Okay. In fact, I was saying on comparative search.
Yeah.
I want us to agree that we're removing, deleting those last three lines. We are taking that one.
Yeah.
South African Police Service Act, there's something added there. In fact, Section 2, that is where we are now.
Mm-hmm.
Members, do they want to comment on that? Honorable Chief?
Just briefly, a grammatical issue. It should be ascertained, not ascertained. And secondly, I'm not convinced that we're reasonably practical is sufficient. We said that they have to have somebody there. I mean, you know, who's going to decide whether it's reasonably practical to have an adult there or not? And the people just say, okay, we make one phone call and so we can't get hold of anybody, so sorry, we're not going to have anyone there. I mean, I really think there's got to be some kind of adult there. If you can't get a parent or guardian, then it must be a social worker or a probation officer or somebody. There's got to be somebody.
Yeah,
you can't say that. I mean, people just say all the time, sorry, it wasn't reasonably practical.
The
flowing
of an hour, can't do that.
Yeah. Members are of the view that to say when, where is maybe practicable, ensure the presence of a parent or guardian or a child or social work.
If I might suggest we take out where reasonably practicable and say ensure the presence of a parent or guardian of the child or a social worker with your comma before order, then that practicable thing is go. That's just a total loophole.
We are saying let's remove where reasonably practicable. Let's say that ensure the presence of a parent or a guardian of the child or a social work.
Yes. Now I'm back.
Madam Chair, thank you for the opportunity. I think keep on not be very careful. Especially when you are dealing with outlying areas where the illustrations are situated. It may become extremely difficult. You have, and if you have then three child, and you now have to find a social worker to be there. It's going to be extremely difficult. It means it. For practical purposes, the child still doesn't want to take any person.
I'm sorry, Chair. I cannot accept that the rights of a child are less in a rural area because it's difficult than they are in the middle of a city. I'm sorry, that we can't have one law for non-rural people and another law for rural people. So I'm sorry, I can't buy that at all. No.
I'm sorry, I agree with my colleague, but I mean, then I'll come up with another suggestion. I mean, if there's some suitable adult that could be pulled in, then, you know, come up with another suggestion, but I don't accept that the police can just take and do what they like with children. They must have some adult there.
Chairperson, the Child Justice Act looks at the following adults. First of all, the parents. Secondly, the guardian. Thirdly, an appropriate adult. And then there's a definition of appropriate adult in the Child Justice Act. And it includes a range of that are there to perform certain functions to protect the child. My suggestion, Chairperson, is that we refer to an appropriate adult instead of a social worker.
No,
appropriate adult as defined in the Child Justice Act.
Yes,
online.
Yeah.
Chairperson, I would suggest that they then use that same definition and define it.
Put it in hand.
Put it in hand. So that it's not a reference back to the
somewhere
else.
Yeah, that's fine. So we are taking appropriate adult, but we'll request that you include that definition here so that we don't have to go to the Child Justice at this time. We want to know who is an appropriate adult.
So are you saying parent,
ensure
guardian?
Ensure the presence of a parent or guardian
or
an appropriate adult.
That's defined.
As
then
defined
then
in the Child Justice Act. And we put the definition there.
Yeah. The whole range.
Chairperson, I just want to make sure. Are you saying that we should refer to the Child Justice Act or simply say an appropriate adult and then insert the definition of appropriate adult?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Chairperson, can we just for our own forget that definition of a defined adult, of an appropriate adult? That's cool.
Chairperson, let's
see if you want to.
Okay, the appropriate adult means any member of a child's family, including a sibling who is 16 years or older, or caregiver referred to in Section 1 of the Children's Act, referred to in Section 1 of the Children's Act, means any member of the child's family, including a sibling who is 16 years or older, or caregiver referred to in Section 1 of the Children's Act.
Chairperson, the inclusion of a caregiver, if you're looking at the Children's Act now, that's why I think it includes a number of people. For instance, a person whose place the child was placed in a place of safety, and it includes the person in charge of a child and youth care center, and I can't remember offhand the rest, but I can get the whole list of them.
Yeah. I see one problem there is that when the chair referred to or a person of 16, but we're talking about appropriate adults, and a 16-year-old is not an adult according to the law. An 18-year-old is an adult. So we can't put in an adult and refer to a 16-year-old. That's just nonsense.
Yeah, I want to just clarify that while I understand the concern around that issue, I think we need to take
cognizant of the reality of child in itself also in the country as well. And I think that is why it's there. And you know, maybe just reconsider that one. I think we need to make it stronger. I mean, this is not to be a fool list. If we are going to include appropriate adults, appropriate persons, then we need to be explicit. Then somehow we need also to have that list of caretakers at or people in charge of the youth centre. We need to have that list available. Because also one must be careful now that the example was used by the police of a street job. Now it's easy enough to go and get an adult at a youth centre. But if that child doesn't have a relationship with that youth centre, is that an appropriate citizen? I think we must keep social work a deputy.
Mm-hmm.
I think we must leave social work here. And then we should go to this part of appropriate person. And I almost want to say it's almost going to be your last
result.
Your last people. The child, I don't understand why it's such a big issue in any case, because the Child Justice Act also refers to probation officers, it refers to all those kinds of people that come into play in the Child Justice Act, which also puts a certain responsibility on the police. And why is it not a problem when it's in the Child Justice Act, but it's a problem when we put it here? So I think we need to balance this. The Child Justice Act says you must in a certain time period get this child to a probation officer, etc. But it's not impossible.
Mm.
It's just, if you've got a delay taking the fingerprint until you've got that person, what's the problem?
Commissioner?
Madam Chair, I will provide the full list. I will get that and provide it to members of the committee.
Definitely. And therefore there is a need for restructuring of just that statement so that we can agree with and please keep doing that so that we can come back to it and adopt it. Okay. Section 36B.
The fact that they've taken into account the gender or age, I mean, they could maybe say take into account their gender and their age and ensure that no body prints are taken by a person of the opposite gender.
Madam Chair, if we go to page 13, there's already a provision that a police official may not examine the body of the person which of a different gender to the police official. We haven't included fingerprints there because we thought that in the case of fingerprints, it's okay that maybe a woman would have a softer approach with children than a male, but when it comes to the body prints and the examination, then it's already covered in the body.
Okay.
Chief,
I might just say it doesn't specify children in that section, and I think we've had throughout, we've been quite careful to deal with adults and children quite separately. So I don't know if we should look to, when we get to that section, maybe review it and look again, maybe add just all children in there. Yeah, we'll come to that.
Okay, but we're accepting D, and therefore what we will expect as we finish is C being restricted, and let's continue then to 36B.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, the basic amendment was in June. You recall we discussed this about the division of the proposal that we have to say a person convicted by a court and sentenced to a term of imprisonment without the option of a fine. Because if it includes any fine, then if the person defaults in paying the fine, then it's overdrawn. You know, just inserted there without the option of a fine.
Okay.
Could I just ask? Could I just ask, and I've looked, and maybe I'm just missing it. Is there a definition of police official? Okay, yeah, we have to remember someone, a bookkeeper or something like that, to define, clearly define someone. All
right. So, 36.1, up to today, we don't have a problem. Please. Is there anything?
No change in email, Madam Chair. There was a change in sub 2 on the page. You'll recall that that provision, which is now in place in 2B, was brought over from the muscle part of the building. In other words, from the previous station, was inserted here. Fingerprints to be taken off the person deep under section 57.6 would have been completed to discuss a fingerprint, which the minister had by notice in the debate to say to be an offence. And Madam Chair, what we have deleted was the provision relating to the suspension or cancellation of licenses in line with what the committee has decided. Madam Chair, I'm not sure it was just in paragraph 4 there was it was put in the positive and the police officer may again take the fingerprint of any person to substitute. And then the rest was only reference to fingerprints of the passenger in fingerprints.
Okay.
And then on page 7, we will just impart reference to fingerprints of the passenger, and then reference to May that has been changed to must. That was confirmed by the section must be the subject of comparative. And that stands for 6A Roman 2 must, upon the conviction of an adult person, be retained on a database expression in chapter 5A. In Roman 2 as well, the may was changed to must upon conviction of the child instead of minor. And then that was also redrafted. Before that, there was a long discussion on this. Now, there's much upon conviction of the child retained on a database referred to in chapter 5A of the SAFA, subject to the provisions relating to the expansion of the conviction and sentence of the child, as provided for in section 87 of the child statute. And that phrase is elsewhere in the act, it has been disclosed earlier. And then Roman 3 was only a substitution for the word preparatory investigation, it means preparatory examination, and it has also been corrected elsewhere in the and see that is all on that page.
Let's start from page 5, remember, 36B, 1, A, B, C, D, changes have eased. There was nothing really that much to be changed, but are we in agreement? I take it members did go through it.
Yeah, there's just one with D. Going back to the person. It must be 36. Okay, I'm just looking for the number. 36D. 36.6D.
Okay.
On page 7.
Okay. Let's go there. Yeah. Maybe for now, let's 36B1, A, B, C, D, E. Mm-hmm. Are we in agreement? Okay. Page 2, I mean section 2, A, B, the effective changes there.
Mm-hmm.
3, the okay. 4, A, B, C, there are no problems there. Okay, 5, 6, Ms. Kolapanatu on page 7.
Section D. It starts any person who uses or allows to use any fingerprint is referred to.
Page 7.
Seven.
Page 7, D.
Any person. Okay, I'm on the graph, yes? Yes, page 7. Any person who uses or allows the use of fingerprints as referred to in the section for any purpose. This is where we send people to jail, alright? Now, I read a more extended version as one, in one of the submissions where I think we've left a possibility out here of someone who, alright, this is just saying if someone uses the fingerprints, but this built on that and said anyone who tampers with or in fact manipulates the fingerprints to show that they belong to someone else who in fact they were not taken from. And that is not not really covered here. For any purpose that is not related to the detection of crime. It's still related to the detection of crime, but they've deliberately put the wrong name on or in fact are trying to frame someone. And that's not covered.
Yes.
This is of course also being the people in the justice.
Yeah, so this is nothing is different. This is training somebody. Yeah. Defeating the end of justice to try and to make sure that the wrong person gets arrested because you're protecting person X is a different story. I think what we're talking about here is the police getting so upset for this committee that put all our fingerprints on
yeah.
a ton of gold. And then the committee gets framed for stealing the ton of gold. That's what we're talking about here. And I think it is important that we actually refer to it. I don't think it's going to do any harm to say that tamper or what was the other word that you used?
Yes, definitely. I'll find the correct insert and I'll raise it when I track it down. It's progressed along, but I will find the correct phrase.
So we'll be coming back here.
Thanks, I'm going to say this as well. At the top of page 8 on that same section, D, the sentence there has not been changed to be the same as the previous one. They've added previously imprisonment without the option of a fine.
Mm.
And I suggest we add that in here as well.
Come again, Ms. Schaefer, I can't begin fully.
D, the last line of D at the top of page 8, and the third line from the top. Previously, they've just put in imprisonment without the option of a fine. They've just spelled it out without the option of a fine. And I just think we should add in those words after imprisonment here as well, to say it without the option of a fine.
Madam Chair, I don't think it's strictly necessary here. The other instance was relating to the issue of the taking of fingerprints. This will in effect mean, if we put it in here, we're actually, there is only provision for imprisonment in this statute. There is no provision for option of fine. I think it's looking at different countries.
It's just that I'm not even following. I'm not even aware as to which section are you talking to, Chief. If you can just take.
They put in specifically without the option of prime, and I don't understand what that logic is, because it said exactly the same thing before there. It also just said, you know, there was also this provision for imprisonment without the option of the prime, and I don't actually understand the difference between this one and the other thing.
Madam Chair, as I explained on page 5 indeed, as it was, just referring to a sentence of term of imprisonment, that could mean including a fine in that context, and we narrowed it down to this, but where you have it as a sentence, if you can be given a term of imprisonment only, and there's no provision in the Act for a fine, then the court cannot impose the sentence of the fine. And it's not, you can really look at all the provisions relating to sentencing in most acts, or in all the acts, there's no reference without an option, it's just the term of imprisonment.
I think then the argument is just let's align when we talk about this.
I understand now. I mean, this first section they're talking about fingerprints of a person who was convicted.
Yes.
So I think it's fine. As long as there's no possible scope for any other interpretation, we can.
Madam Chair, the problem is if you do that now in this sentencing, if you create interpretation problems in relation to other legislation. So I think it's correct as we have. I can confirm there's not a possibility for a fine.
So on this one, we'll come back to section D.
I'll find it.
Come back.
I found it on the plane this morning. It took a while.
Insert whatever. Otherwise, we don't have problems with all other sections.
Can you read one thing? I just want to ask a question. Subsection 1, if you just say subsection 1, 1B, and it's the 1B taken out, and I don't know, it's just a drafting thing that applies to the whole section. Because 1D is the only one that applies to that specific thing, it's a correct subject.
Huh?
It's subsection 8 on page 8. It used to say
we can read the D.
Yeah.
So what are we asking there?
On page 8, Madam Chair, subsection 8, we refer to subsection 1, D in brackets.
D. Okay. moving on to 36C.
Thank you, Madam Chair. 36C, on page 9, there were only minor changes, fingerprints, D, 36.1B, we just changed the word in the last line of B, the word D to those. In other words, it believes that the print or the result of an examination thereof will be of value in the investigation by excluding or including one or more of those persons as possible for the justice of the state. Subsection 2A, be examined for the purposes of the investigation of the current offence or cause to be so examined. That there's no change there. And then the next line only reads now be subjected to a comparative search. We have deleted there for cause to be so examined. because within that context, it doesn't make any sense.
Yes.
Then, Madam Chair, in D, with only correction of fingerprints, in 3A1, the word may that has been changed to must, and then we have deleted in Roman 1 the word after it has fulfilled the purposes for which it was taken or analyzed, which we have deleted throughout the course. Chair, in Roman 2, it is just that alignment, as I've already said, we redrafted this clause and it was indicated in this form in the rest of the book. In Roman 3, just the substitution for preparatory investigation, it is now in preparatory examination. And in Roman 3, there was just that in the last line, which leads to the South African Police Service Act, instead, having been notified to the search firm that it has been notified. In these fingerprints, just the correction of fingerprints, and in D, the word conduct in the last line of D changed to conducting of prosecution, and then as you will see, everywhere we refer to the purposes for which fingerprints may be taken, we have stated also included the part of identification of the fingerprints and identification of human remains. In C, Madam Chair, it was just the correction of fingerprints. In D, it was also the correction of the word fingerprints. And then we've also inserted that phrase, identification of missing persons, etc., for the conducting of the prosecution. And then, since there were two, on conviction three, person and other students at the year. And Chair, in E, then only the introduction of the word fingerprint, and in S, the phrase for the user that delegate that was deleted. Also the capitalization of the certificate of expansion and the direction of the expansion.
Thank you, A. Take 9, 1A, 2, 3, any question or any comment? None. Page 10, Roman.
Yes, Roman, could we just go back? I found the piece I was referring to.
No, let's go back.
We'll go back at it. Sure, okay. Yes, I've got it.
Yeah. In page 10, Roman figure 2, 3, B, C, I think it's corrections effected. Page 11, D, E, F, and if we don't have problems with that, we're moving on to 3. In fact, up to 3, there's nothing, so we can proceed to section 37.1.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Section 37, on the first page, there were just the references that were corrected to the fingerprint, and underlining, there's actually no substantive reason on that page 12. Madam Chair, then C on page 13, where you see at the end that the proviso provided that a police official may not take a blood sample of any person, nor shall a police rephrase that shall to examine the body of a person who is of a different gender to the police official. Before Madam Chair, there was some discussion on the specific wording there.
Could I ask, may I ask what provision there is, and I'm presuming there is provision somewhere, of the dealings of a transsexual, of people of other genders? And there are. and there are many in this country. So what provision is made, I presume it's made somewhere. There are people in mid-transition or transgendered. What provisions do you make as to who can examine?
Madam Chair, I don't think there is such a provision, because I think the person must be dealt with in terms of his status as being registered with the Department of Home Affairs. There is no other practical way in which you can actually be able to deal with that.
So the sex of the person is determined by a Home Affairs, registered as a woman or as a man with Home Affairs. I think it will be very difficult for police to say I'm a man when I'm saying I'm a woman. Surely the documents of proof to who I am. It will be very difficult. Otherwise, you need a doctor.
Mm.
But even the doctor may necessarily not say I'm a woman when I'm a man. Yes. I think we have requested that you relook section 2A. Can you just take us through on this one so that we agree?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, there was a long discussion on this in the committee, and we might want to relook at this issue. Any medical officer of any prison or requested data by any police official, any registered medical practitioner or registered nurse might take such steps, including taking of a blood sample, as may be necessary in order to ascertain whether the body of any prison has any mark, etc. Madam Chair, after our deliberations, we must recommend to the committee that it should be retained as it is in the Act of Amendment, in other words, my state. But even if you were trying to that much state, then it wouldn't make sense in terms of the rest of the provision, because the second part says, as might be deemed necessary. In other words, there is a discretion in any case basis in that. So our recommendation is keep the Act as it is, in other words, my state.
I can see another project is agreeing with you.
Yes.
Okay. That's fine, let's continue.
B.
Section B. Is there anything? I think we have accepted section B.
Okay, could I just ask, in section B, and it was raised in one of the notes, it says here, a medical practitioner attached to any hospital. Now, what if the person is being treated by a private doctor who's not actually attached to the hospital, but is that person's private doctor? That then rules out a great many medical professionals who are not specifically attached to a specific hospital. They might be in private practice, you see?
Madam Chair, as I read it, it is any registered medical practitioner.
Attached to any
registered medical practitioner, it's not anything at all.
But you're
you are protected. But it's here, any registered medical practitioner attached to any hospital. So I think we've got, if you want us to correct that, let's correct it.
It's not in this one, but it is in that one.
But
it's
section A, it doesn't say anything, and section B is attached to the hospital, and that's only if people come to the hospital and they see that something looks funny. It doesn't apply to if the police ask them to do it, then it's anything.
That's very clear. In the first part of the sentence, I think, explains it. If any registered medical practitioner attached to any hospital, it is where the person is being admitted to the hospital.
Yeah.
So it's only relevant in the circumstance that the shape of the hospital.
I think it's correct because this one is talking about somebody who is at a hospital,
yes,
being admitted for treatment. And section A talks to
about any
doctor.
Yes.
Including a prison doctor. Yeah. I think it's covered. Yes. I think members are a little bit out of order today. I don't know whether it's because after a long weekend. Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sub-3, we were only these minor amendments to correct the issue of fingerprints without or with a dash. That has been taken care of in sub-3. There's no other standard amendment there. In sub-4, also correction of the issue of fingerprints, no substantive amendment. Then, Madam Chair, if we get to sub-5, any fingerprints, body prints, or photographic images taken under any power conferred by this section, there was a reference to and in the first line, any fingerprints, body prints, and photographic, that has been changed to 4 instead of and. And in the 6A as well, the and was also changed to all. In other words, the subject in subsection 7, the body prints, or photographic images. Madam Chair, in Roving 1, the may has been changed to must, to read must upon the conviction of an adult child, of an adult person being retained on a database provided for the SUS Act. And then in Roman 2, it is that redrafted reference to the Child Justice Act that has been changed here. In Roman 3, the reference to preparatory investigation changed to preparatory examination. That is all in Roman 3. In B, bottom of page 16, there was just a change with a reference to the word conduct, which is now conducting, and also the reference to the insertion about the identification of certain persons, and unidentified in your mind, etc. And Chair, in C, also the reference to identification of missing persons and unidentified human remains and the work conducted as changed. In D, Madam Chair, the body prints or that or has been inserted instead of and. And we've deleted the reference to the National Commissioner's delegate as also in the book. And then in 7, no against the Madam Chair.
Okay.
I think that is the section.
That is section 7. Page 12, I think we don't have challenges there. Page 13, we are accepting that change. And 14 as well. Page 15, there's nothing. Page 16.
See.
Okay.
Yeah. Chair, yes, I found an extended section. I'm just trying to see it by the fabric. One of the submissions given to us suggests that we put in any person who tampers with, manipulates, or in any way changes fingerprints. Or non-intimate samples of any description, and any police official who submits fingerprints or samples falsely claiming it to have been taken from a specific person whilst knowing it to have been taken from another person or source is then guilty of an offence. So it's expanding
this section slightly to cover other eventualities.
I don't think one can be too careful to cover eventualities of others, possibilities as well. But I don't know whether one's got to go, I mean, that makes it very broad. And whether we shouldn't just say any person who uses without the use of the photo, who uses or manipulates the use of. And I think one must include photographic images in it as well, because it's quite easy to manipulate photographic images via computer systems. So bring in the word manipulate. Any person who, what I'm suggesting to you is any person who uses or manipulates or who allows to use or manipulation of body prints, photographic images, fingerprints, as refers to. And you can do that even with the prior section as well, the manipulation of.
Yeah. Chair, the sentence that gives me a problem here is that a person who uses these other than in an investigation of an offence. Now, we're still looking at the investigation of offence, but it's the manipulation of, that's giving you the wrong person's fingerprints or etc. So it is still the investigation of an offence, and they may say, oh, but I was still investigating and how did I know? But they're deliberately putting the wrong print down at the scene of a crime or putting the wrong name against the print. So I have this. Shall I just hand it over to you, this little section which I thought was quite interesting?
I think it will still be manipulation.
Yeah.
At whatever level, that's before, during, or after, it will still be manipulation. And I think that adding the word manipulation will protect us at some point.
That's good. That's good.
Yes. We have to say who uses, allowed to be used, manipulated, or allowed to be manipulated. Fingerprint or photographic image.
Can you therefore read the whole? Not a person who uses.
Any person who uses, allowed to be used, or allowed the use of, manipulated, or allowed to be manipulated.
For any purpose not related to the detection of crime. You see, the rest of the sentence is made for nonsense.
So you're getting that?
I'm getting it. I think it's correct to refer him to Matthew, because even if it refers to the investigation, if it is to blame a person for an offence, on which you falsely implicate a person in the investigation.
State law advisor? State law advisor? They're still consulting. If time continues, we'll come back to you, please. Okay. Page 4, so we'll still be coming back to this one, just to finalize it. Section 4. I think other sections are fine. Section 4.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I can just mention that, of course, we took out clause 8, which we had in before, because it was covered in that clause 2 in the beginning, where we referred to the taking of fingerprints of staff. So that's the reason why it was taken out. 4, Madam Chair, there was no real mention on page 18. Instead of the references to fingerprints that has been exercised, if you go to page 19, Madam Chair, the B part, also implication of the reference to fingerprints, editorial issues, Madam Chair, there's nothing real in the standard there. We go to page 20, the same with sub 8 on page 20, only the reference to fingerprints that has been collected. That is for the whole page. Page 21, Madam Chair. just editorial issues like underlining and reference to fingerprint that has been amended. Madam Chair, shall I continue with the next part as well?
Section 4, I think on page 18, there's nothing. Page 19, there's really nothing. I think even the spelling has been corrected. Page 20, there's fingerprint on top there with the case, which must be corrected. Yes.
On page 18A, it's just a numbering issue, I think. 1, 2, Roman numeral 1, 2, 3, 1, V. Then I think it should be V.
Page 20, fingerprint with the dash, we remove the dash. I think we've done this. Okay, 21 is fine. Section 5. Commissioner Teko.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, once again, only the reference to fingerprints was corrected on page 22, page 23. In session of chapters 5A and 3, Madam Chair, on page 23, there were no minor amendments except for fingerprints, still. And in section 8, insertion of all instead of and, in other words, it means the National Commission must ensure that fingerprint body prints all photographic images taken under this Act, etc. And here, page 24, we removed in subsection 2 the reference to the usual advocate of the National Commissioner, and we specify the spelling of fingerprints. And in subsection 3, also to stress this board, instead of stamps in the second line, in other words, the fingerprint body is enforced for the graduation, and corrected the filling of fingerprints. In subsection 4, only fingerprints and fingerprints, and then the insertion of the reference to identification of missing persons and identification of human remains. And the spelling of the conducting. And then in subsection 5, it just was just quickly more in the process of subsection 4 does not prohibit the use by the police officer commanding the division of the service and the fingerprints that were changed in the spelling. Okay, page 25, only reference to fingerprints and 4 the same. Continue, Madam Chair, only fingerprints and the word conducting in subsection 1 and the reference to identification of missing persons, etc. In subsection 2, the first line, any person who conducts A, it was N, the first sentence was A. And in subsection 2, there was still reference to a fine. And
Page 25, comparative check against other databases, we are fine. Any okay, 15C.
Thank you, Madam Chair. 15C. Currently, the amendment in 15C1A of fingerprint selected. That is all on page 26. On page 27, Madam Chair, there was a request from the Chair that we should insert a subsection 2 to read the national instructions referred to in subsection 1.
must be present in
both.
It's not in the text at the moment, the chair is asking the chair that they have to
there's such a suggestion of the national instruction taking into cognizance what the child's Child Justice Act says, and we don't have national instruction today. It is said within 6 months, we said so, and was to say maybe the Parliament must be informed for noting that they are there within that period. Yes.
I'm going to say, what's the purpose of noting, and what happens if they don't? What remedies are there? I mean, we don't have any control at all, that's my only concern. I mean, it's a good idea that we have a time limit and that we see it, but I don't think, I'm not sure that we've got any real power to answer that.
Thank you, Chair.
It
also depends, not in discretion, it also depends what the committee intends being in this deal, in this process. Because voting is just maybe a notice of the particular structure being taken in. I think considerations being committed with that term, maybe the feedback is for approval,
yes.
And it's much broader as such.
Or we leave it out, simple.
And a bit of approval. So actually, to leave it out, then you know you must put it in.
Yeah, put it in, absolutely. Commissioner Caldenis is requesting that we leave out.
That's why I said
that. Yeah.
It must be tabled with a B, just a correction. But I think that the general feeling was when we last met that the regulations must be brought to us to go through before they're tabled. I mean, that was how we were thinking the last time we met. Because all too often these regulations evaporate, or they actually are not in the sense of the spirit of the bill.
Can I just are we talking instruction or a regulation? Because to me, a regulation and instruction are two different things.
Mm-hmm.
And if we're talking instruction, I don't believe, because that's more operational. I don't believe that must come from finance. That is why I think we've covered ourselves if we say they must be given within 6 months. Well, we can't decide now what we'll do with them if they don't do that. We'll find means of dealing with them.
Okay. So we're leaving, we
yeah.
6 months is fine.
Yeah.
Okay, fine.
That's what
they do. But we'll still invite you to come to Parliament because we don't have national instructions for Child Justice Act. We don't. That's the thing. We don't have them. That is why you will think about all these things. You set precedent, and we have to act on these things because they really are worrying.
And it's really quite right, but it's not really, it shouldn't be for us to do that, and actually, you know, the minister should be calling those people in who fall under their ministry and take whatever action is needed.
Okay, so we're taking that, we're not including that. Okay, 15D.
Thank you, Madam Chair, on page 27, 15D. Probably the reference is to the usual delegate of the National Commissioner that has been defeated. That other mention on page 28, also in subsection 3, the division of usual delegate, special National Commissioner. And then just the last one, after subsection 3, we have a change to the clear respect of and use of it related to. In terms of specific laws and regulations relating to education, subsection 4 was quite a discussion at the previous meeting. What we proposed is to say that the National Commissioner and the Director General of Departments of Transport, Home Affairs and Correctional Services must jointly, within 6 months of the commencement of the section, develop standards on the procedures.
Yeah.
subsection 5, other data writers may only be assessed in terms of standard operating procedures preserved in subsection 4.
I'm just worried that this all, the part of the discussion was that somebody needs to take the lead. We sit in under the leadership of under the chairmanship of the medical commissioner. Because we ultimately want to keep somebody responsible. Then I want to ask Jessica, as a matter of interest that it also influenced the section, who would then only sign memorandum of understanding? Is it the DC or is it the minister?
When it relates to relations between different departments, it should be the accounting officer, which will be the DG. But Madam Chair, it differs. Some legislation you provide for, like MOUs, normally within such they're concluded, but because they're standard operating procedures. But of course, it can be an MOU that is signed by the National Commissioner as the accounting officer.
Jefferson,
can I ask
that all lawyers agree
as
then the lawyers are like economists, don't worry. They don't agree on anything. Economists,
ever.
Some would say recession, others say no, we are just going to, others will say no, we're out. Only doctors agree when they miss my
counsel. Madam Chair, I don't agree, but let me just make even law requires the minister to enter into the memorandum of understanding or whatever. Then obviously the minister must be.
I told you.
Yeah.
Now let me go to another lawyer.
Another lawyer, yes, come on. Give us another option.
I don't think this is adequately covered. I mean, is he understanding why we fall under the key character? Because this is what he related to. Well, otherwise, I would suggest you write in there that the Minister of Police shall ensure that the National Commissioner and the public. The reason I think we must remind ourselves why this is an issue. It's an issue because it involves other databases from other departments where people give their fingerprints not because they are criminals, but to abide to the law. And we're trying to protect the integrity of those databases. Now, one of these very many lawyers around these tables sent me a message to say that the banks have got an agreement. The fact of the matter is the banks have got agreement with Home Affairs that took longer than 7 years to reach. And where the memorandum of understanding was signed between the minister of that department and the banking council's chief executive officer, and that memorandum of understanding took 2 years to sign, to get to a point where it's actually agreement. And it's because of that, and it's a limited access. It's simply saying, yes, it is, or no, it isn't this person on the database. And the reason for that has been the integrity of the database. And that's why I'm asking this question. We're talking about legal implications also for other departments. And that's why I'm asking this question. Somehow, I mean, I want this truth. I'm not trying to delay it. all I'm saying to you is that we must be very, very, very sure that what we are doing here, we are satisfied that that ultimate responsibility will be taken for the integrity of all databases. We found it necessary to put in this legislation that people cannot manipulate fingerprints, cannot manipulate photographic images, etc. That means we've got a greater responsibility, and there we're talking about the police's database. That means we've got an even greater responsibility when we talk about other departments' databases. That's why I'm stressing this point. I'm not trying to be difficult. I really want to know, and I think maybe Ms. Shesa has started to touch on the solution, is that we put a responsibility to the minister to ensure that his director general does that. But I'm still not comfortable that we're giving the required acknowledgement to the other. I'm really not trying to be difficult. I'm just, for me, it's
natural.
Yeah, I never try to be difficult. It comes naturally. It just comes naturally. But yeah, I'm really just concerned. I mean, we at the end of this, we're all wondering, but I mean, you know, whether it's really necessary to have this discussion. But in the end, everything that we've put in this legislation, we've put in because we want to protect the integrity of the database. At SAS, so much so, I believe we've got a responsibility to protect the database of transport, of foreign affairs, and whoever else may come up later. And also the priority, sorry, Sue, there's a question of priority as well. Because, and it's no negative reflection on the police, but for the police, what they want now, and it's the same issue we asked when we talked about the medical practitioner. Going into a hospital, and the doctor might say to you, no, sorry, I'm busy with somebody whose life is actually threatened, you know, who I need to give attention to immediately. The same thing goes in terms of priorities. And that was part of the memorandum of understanding, is the priority that the department, the guest department, if I can put it that way, the host department, would put on the request from SAPS. Or do you envisage, because currently it's not there, or do you envisage that at some point, yes, I believe, the databases will talk to one another. But at this point, that's the reality.
They don't.
So it means that you will come with a request to a department and the department will actually look at it. And that's why I say this is a bigger issue than just me being naturally difficult.
Yeah. Chair, I think leaving this point four with the equivalent of the 1, 2, 3, 4 DGs all on an equal basis means who will chair. I think Annalise's point is absolutely correct. There's got to be somebody who's driving it. And considering the fact that currently, basically, Department of Transport, there's no link, you can't link ENARTIS to the SAP system. This is all in a SAP document, one of them. And it's the same with Correctional Services. Home Affairs will only do the request if they have the personnel capacity, which they currently don't have. So this whole issue is being driven by SAT. And they must lead it. And they must get the buy-in of the others. So I really think that the commissioner needs to chair it, but on the instruction of the minister. And if there are problems, then the minister must step in and he must meet with the other ministers and sort them out. But if you just have these four people meeting on an equal basis, they will meet till the cows come home and we'll never see a thing come out of it. I mean, there's got to be someone leading the team, and as SAPs are driving this, and SAPs who are insisting that the other databases be pulled into line to give them the access, it's got to be SAPs who lead the charge and take any dramas that come with it.
In fact, that was what we raised last week.
Yeah.
And it's probably let's hear from you to why it's still not part of this, because that's what we see. That if they meet on an equal basis, then nobody is going to invite or take the responsibility to call others to a meeting.
Okay.
Chair, is the decision then that it must be the Minister of Police that must ensure that these DGs under the leadership of the National Commissioner put into the
That was the decision last week already, under the chairmanship of the National Commissioner. What we're discussing now is over and above issue. The decision last week, and that's what the chair is asking, last week we said, under the chairmanship of the National Commissioner, and it's not reflecting that. So that's the one thing. The second thing that we are discussing is whether we should involve the minister on that, if I understand correctly.
Madam Chair, if I can make one remark. Everything that the National Commission has done, is done subject to the direction of the minister. So it's not necessary to give the minister the power to give direction to the National Commission for any type of decision.
I'm just thinking. You know, with the safety sports and recreational event, one other issue that was seriously raised was the fact that the Minister of Sport cannot instruct the National Commission on anything. So it becomes a problem if you say the Minister now, then you include Director General of other departments. It becomes a political problem. And that is why I personally think that the chairmanship of the National Commissioner at the level of colleagues meeting as per the Act will suffice, I would think. So otherwise it becomes a political dilemma. Yes.
We just can't have the word jointly because then it's not going to happen. So if we agree on that, then I would say we need that the National Commissioner shall come together with the Director General, blah, 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 to assist with the interest. So then the National Commissioner has the responsibility, the Minister can then oversee the National Commissioner.
So that's what Darwin was last week. We said the National Commissioner under the chairmanship of the National Commissioner, because the fact of the matter is, again, you need to have the cooperation of the other DGs. You've also got this whole thing of the intercooperative governance comes into play. So he can't instruct DGs either. So it's got to be under the chairmanship. It's a joint exercise, but under the chairmanship. And we're having this discussion for another 10, 15 minutes because the changes that we agreed on last week was not effective again. That's why we're having the changes and the discussion for
some time. Okay, we therefore are going to effect a change then. Yes. Okay. We're coming back to that. Definitely here. Okay, section 7. We're done with that. Okay.
Madam Chair, on page 28 and 29, just the amendments to the Firearms Control Act. Madam Chair, we have just aligned the definitions here with the definitions in the Criminal Procedure Act, and on the text that we have with us now, we will also be in the definition of comparative search, that last 3 lines that we have been in the Criminal Procedure Act definition as well. Madam Chair, on page 50, just on top of the page, body prints, the dash is misspelled. We correct that in the final version. On the left of the page, there were no other amendments from the previous discussion.
We'll come back to the
next one.
Let's continue, sir. We'll come back to
the next one. On page 51, also in the alignment with in subsection 5, 8, especially in paragraph 2, as I said, in alignment with the wording in the Criminal Procedure Act. And in 3, the word examination instead of investigation, and also the just examination. In Madam Chair, on page 32, in paragraph B, the insertion relating to the identification of missing persons and human remains and also conducting of prosecution. The identification in C of the spelling of fingerprints. The addition in C also of the reference to a fine, and in D, the next on page 32, the bottom, the amendment of the Explosives Act. And the amendment that we have affected here is also in line with that that I've already discussed on the Criminal Procedure Act as well as the Environment Control Act. So on page 33 and 34, there's only those issues that have been discussed and a lot of the other two issues. And here on page 35, Roman 2 was the amendment relating to the reference to the Child Justice Act, which has been in line. And in Roman 3, it was with preparatory examination, which has been inserted there, page 56. Only the reference in B. And unidentified human remains and also the word conducting. We see the application of the word fingerprints and spelling. We see also the reference to a fine that has been muted. And indeed, the reference to the delegate of the National Commission that has been muted.
Okay, page 31, page 30. Is there anything we want to say? Nothing. Page 31. I just want.
On page 29, body prints, I think, just moved up into A. After authorized person body prints, because then you've got insert of the definition of cartridge child.
You agree with that? Okay. Just that you're on page 29.
You've got all these different documents.
Yeah. Looking to another page. Okay. Page
31. If I remember correctly, there was a lot of discussion about the phrase bodily samples versus just blood samples. Bodily samples may be taken from a person. I'm not sure what the definition of bodily samples. I certainly understand blood being drawn. But I don't know what the definition of bodily sample, I don't know what it includes. Have we got it clearly defined somewhere?
Madam Chair, we did discuss this in the meeting. The decision of the committee was that we're not going to define it. It has never been defined in the Criminal Procedure Act or the Firearms Control Act or the Explosives Act. And the decision was that we're not going to define it here. Because we are going to deal with the issue of infamous non-infamous samples that we try in the second round of this talk.
of this receptor.
And the fact is that if you look at page 34, subsection 3, body samples to be taken from a body of a patient are only taken by a representative medical practitioner.
You know, except that in all other sections, you when you refer to Child Justice Act 2008, you then say Act number, but not on page 8. It's just there on page 8 where you just say Child Justice Act finished. But on all other pages, you are actually referring to the Act. I think they surely must be consistent. Just to add that on that page.
If I can just explain, for purposes of the criminal procedure, we have defined Child Justice Act. So wherever we use it in the Criminal Procedure Act amendment, we just refer to the Child Justice Act, comma. But in the Firearms Control Act and the Explosives Act, it was not, so that's why it seems like an
okay, okay. Okay. 31, 32. That the three comparative sets, the definition is set up to X, isn't it? So we're deleting the irrespective of whether, yes. 34.
Yes. On 34,
probably you will say actually yeah, the section.
It's 9-2.
Yes.
Is it matter of death 9-2B? Is it may cause any prince to be and it should be to be the subject of A, or at least change the N to an A, comparative search. But are we sure that it's may and not must? Because if you look at the other provisions in the Act, we say they must be subject to comparative search when you take. So are we happy that over here it should be may?
Madam Chair, I think there's elsewhere where they have must be on. It's telling that it is actually really there to be made. Because this is a power that's been granted. I think we must be consistent in refer to it every day.
Johan, they've copied you. Are they?
Yes, sir, but I think I've heard it.
Before it's manipulation.
Yeah, my view is just an empowering position. The big difference is if the purpose of taking all these prints are to populate the database, then you need the empowering position to populate the database. The purpose is to take thousands of prints and run comparative searches, then you must say very clearly it will be much. So I leave it up very fully to make this decision. I've asked them whether it's practicable for them to deal with a must. And they convinced me that I've got to be part of my case.
So May is fine. So we're taking that consciously. So 35. 36. 36. Then we're going back to page 5. Section 2C. Commissioner Kaldane. Page 5.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
There's a 1C.
Number 2A and B. Is 36A2C. Where reasonably practicable, ensure the presence of a parent or a guardian child. That is where we are now. Yes, sir.
Can I just make one remark? I think it's important that you understand that Parliament adopted the Child Justice Act. And in the Child Justice Act, Parliament felt it appropriate to ensure the protection of children and inter alia included as the protection of children an appropriate adult. Now the definition of an appropriate adult in the Child Justice Act, like you rightly referred to earlier on, also refers to the definition of the Children's Act. Now Now let me just quickly read to you exactly what is the care given in terms of the children of family. It means any person other than a parent or guardian who factually cares for a child, and includes a foster parent, a person who cares for a child with implied or express consent of a parent or guardian of the child, a person who cares for a child within the child while the child is in temporary safe care, the person at the head of a child and youth care center where a child has been placed, the person at the head of a shelter, a child and youth care worker who cares for a child who is without appropriate family care in the community. So, Madam Chair, I took them together and drafted something, a definition of appropriate adult, which will cover all of them. And I'm very briefly going to read it, and you will see that it encompasses all the other definitions. Appropriate adult means any member of a child's family, including a sibling who is 16 years or older, or a caregiver of the child, which includes any person other than a parent or guardian who factually cares for a child, including a foster parent, a person who cares for a child with implied express consent of the parent, a person who cares for a child while the child is in temporary second care, the person at the head of the child at the youth care center where the child is in place, the person at the head of the shelter, the child and youth care worker who cares for a child without appropriate family care in the community, and the child at the head of the child in the household if such a child is in the community. Now, I have noted the remarks earlier on about the child who is 16 years or older, who is given the authority to actually support the child. Where you have a child in the household, and the child who is the head of that household is 16 years or older, in terms of the Child Justice Act, that person is fully entitled to protect the child right through the process, legal documentation, court process, responsibility to take the child for assessment, etc., etc. My suggestion is that we follow the same approach and that we allow those persons to be present with fingerprints of the child.
Yes, I think generally finally check we specifically said we wanted social worker included as well, which is there. So we can add that in. And secondly, perhaps just say an appropriate person, not an appropriate adult, because of the fact that we are providing for children under 18 as well.
Okay. Now we are on section C. So are we, is that addressing section C now?
I think if actually resolved the issue of a child of 16 years when we're talking about it. But it just becomes certain. But I think again, like we said last week, can we have it in writing so that we can look at it? It's very difficult just to listen to these things. So before we can actually vote on it, we need to have it in writing.
We will be happy if we can have it in writing as well as section C so that we vote on something that is written. So we're going to please put it in writing so that we can vote on something that is in writing. Page 8, the manipulation section D. We want something written there again because we want to vote on something that is in black and white. There. I think it's page 17 as 16.
Yeah, 16C. I mean, it's on page 16 and it's 16C.
Yeah, it goes to 17, 16 and 17.
Yeah,
it surely must be written.
Let me see what it looks like. Can I ask a silly question, but won't it make sense, since we feel so strong about the manipulation, the use of this, to have a separate clause just dealing with if one should abuse, use it for something else, manipulate, etc. It will be an offence and it will be punishable by a jail sentence for 15 years. All encompassing clause that can deal with all of these issues. It also then addressed Ms. Kurobana's concern about the broader use of it. So what I'm basically asking for here is a separate clause just dealing with if any person should be found to deal, to manipulate, use for other than, and that we included there. And then we can also, that manipulation thing also refers to photographic images, bodies, etc.
And on in that one, let me say, let's take a 5 minute break, come back and allow our specialist there to make his presentation. After his presentation, then we're going to adopt the spirit of that. Where we're going to have everything in black and white. So can we just have 2 minutes, I mean 5 minutes break, then come back, we take a presentation, then we move, we go back to the bill itself, adopting it. This is where the work of Parliament happens. I think the constructive work of Parliament. And indeed, we have to process a bill on DNA, which we were supposed to process together with this one, which we are dealing with today, but we felt that it's going to take long. When we got this one, it's easier maybe to process, and I think we took a correct decision. As a portfolio committee, we said it will be important for us to conduct a comparative study, including international tools, so that as we embark on that process, we know exactly what other countries are doing. We don't repeat mistakes that have been committed by other countries. And your presence here also talks to that decision of the portfolio committee, even if you may have not been aware. But we are very happy that you are with us today. We'll allow you to properly introduce yourself and, of course, to go ahead with the presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and other honorable members, for the opportunity to be here. I've been very privileged to testify before a number of bodies around the world, and few, however, have been as lovely as Cape Town. When I drove in yesterday, I had the privilege of seeing, I understand, the southeasterly winds roll down the mountain, and it looked like an avalanche. It was just beautiful, and so again, I appreciate the opportunity to be here. I was in Pretoria for a meeting where we were discussing on Human Rights Day, in fact, the application of DNA technology in human rights context and some of the advantages and opportunities that we see lie in the future for that. And I will tell you that I started that presentation off by referencing Winston Churchill's comment that democracy is the worst form of government, except for every other form of government.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that the work that this body does is difficult and can be tedious and can be contentious, but that just adds to the value of the public service that you provide as you seek to look at issues and ways to maximize the potential, in this case, to maximize the potential of forensic technology, ultimately to save lives, protect victims, and also to protect the innocent. I think that whenever we talk about DNA databasing in the context of DNA databasing, there are a couple of kind of foundational issues that we begin with. And the first is what I just said about anytime we look at implementing a DNA database, we necessarily have to realize that it is not just about the conviction of the guilty and the protection of victims. It is also about the protection of the innocent. While I lived in London for 4 years, I have since moved back to the United States, and I'm obviously American. And in my own country, we have identified between 150 to 200 people that were absolutely wrongly convicted at a time when DNA was not utilized, but we've gone back and we've looked at their cases, we've looked at their evidence, and we've determined that they were actually innocent individuals. Some of them were on death row. While we haven't proven this, there's no doubt in my mind that some of the people that we have executed over the years, if we had had DNA back then, we could have exonerated them. And we have even had a number of cases through our DNA database where identification in the DNA database exonerated someone else without that other person ever asking to be exonerated. You know, they weren't part of the system. But because of some of the linkages in cases, our database proved that we had gotten it wrong in other cases. And I'm a former prosecutor, and I'll go through my background in a minute. I'm a former prosecutor, and I'm pretty proud of our system, but I recognize that it's a system run by human beings, and as such, we're going to make mistakes. And if you maximize the potential of DNA, you maximize the ability to limit those mistakes. Again, my background, I started as a prosecutor. My specialty was prosecuting sex crimes against children, and I did that for 6 years. And that's how I started into DNA technology, understanding the potential of DNA technology. When I left that job, I became the director of the DNA unit for the National District Attorneys Association. So I spent 2 years training prosecutors and police all over the United States on how to implement DNA technology into their prosecution. When I left that job, I became an assistant United States attorney. I was a federal prosecutor in the U.S. Department of Justice. And I was asked by the Attorney General of the United States to run something called the National Commission on the Future of DNA Evidence. And what that commission did was look at all of these policy considerations regarding implementing DNA, not just from a databasing standpoint, but also what were the legal issues, what were the scientific issues, what were the funding issues. You know, it doesn't happen without the appropriate funding. And what were the, what we call post-conviction exoneration issues. So for 4 years I did that, and as such I was the advisor to first Attorney General Reno and then Attorney General Ashcroft on the implementation of forensic DNA in the United States. When I left the department, I began consulting internationally, and I've worked in about 35 different countries. I've testified before a number of legislatures and parliaments, and again, I'm pleased to be here with you. I talked about one of the foundations of talking about DNA rests in the understanding that we're talking about the protection of the innocent every bit as much as we're talking about the conviction of the guilty and the protection of victims of crime and future victims of crime. But another foundational understanding is what we're dealing with when we talk about forensic DNA itself. And I think it's really important to understand that when we talk about the kind of DNA that we use in the criminal justice system is fundamentally different than DNA in general and the kind of DNA that you think about when people talk about cloning and things like that. Understand that when the research was being done to decide what sections of the DNA we were going to look at in a criminal justice context, part of that process was to determine those sections of the DNA which very specifically cannot tell us anything else about you as a human being. The sections of the DNA that we scientifically evaluated, we evaluated to make sure that even if we wanted to, while we were looking at these sections of DNA, we couldn't tell anything about your age, your predisposition to diseases, your current disease status, or anything like that. The sections we look at were designed, weren't designed, but were selected, because they are only good in our context for identifying that a biological material from one place, from a crime scene, was the same, you know, matched the person who was in our database otherwise. So again, the selection of the DNA that we look at, I think, is really important from an understanding of what of one of the most fundamental protections built into the system already, and one of the most important protections, and when I say protections, I mean protections against abuse of human rights violations and such. The foundation of that is what we look at in the first place. Another foundational issue to consider when we're talking about DNA technology is, and I know that this is going to be a long process, but the speed at which we ultimately implement DNA databasing laws and then ultimately are able to implement that process from a criminal justice standpoint, that will be counted in people's lives in a way that's different than any other criminal investigative technique or forensic technology. Because DNA is so effective at identifying perpetrators in some of our most heinous crimes, right? Because it is so identifying and so reliable, our failure to do so is a real problem. And that comes up in the context of backlogs. I know we've talked about backlogs. But if we implement this law and the system next year, or let's say 3 years from now as opposed to next year, there are going to be any number of people within that time frame that are going to be victimized, rape, murdered, et cetera, molested, that otherwise wouldn't be if we had gotten to it sooner. And I say that coming from a country that has a backlog at any given time of 50 to 100,000 samples in the United States. Our turnaround time for DNA testing in the United States is regularly about a year. We're horrible at it.
Mm-hmm.
We don't do it well. What that means is that we have people being victimized who are only being victimized, not because we don't have the technology, not because we don't have the know-how, but because we're not moving quickly enough. And failure to move quickly enough counts in people's lives, and you know who they are. What happens is, and this is a dynamic that has happened all over the world, someone will be raped in 6 months in K-Town. A year and a half from now, when this system finally gets implemented, we'll go back and that DNA profile will get put into the system a year or two from now. And what we'll realize is that the perpetrator who committed that crime could have been caught earlier, could have been identified earlier if we had been instituting a system earlier, if we'd been testing earlier, et cetera. So we'll know exactly who were raped and who was murdered, et cetera, by nature of the time lag that goes on. And so again, I recognize that this is a process that needs to be gone through. It's a long process, but this is a dynamic that every country that has ever considered DNA databasing has had to face. How quickly do we do this? Because we can be saving lives. Now, all that being said, I apologize that it's not up on the screen. We're having some international communication issues in that my U.S. laptop doesn't seem to be speaking to your projector. But you do all have the PowerPoint presentation in front of you. So let me refer to that and start with this proposition. I truly believe that the South African system can become a model, not just for criminal justice systems in Africa, but quite literally around the world. I say that having been here about 8 years ago, having seen the robotic system that you have, understanding the quality and the nature of the work that the South African Police Service currently does is very good. Given the infrastructure that you already have, given the sophisticated laboratory system that you've already, I say, wisely invested in, okay, when you ultimately pass this law and you ultimately begin to implement this technology in a way that really maximizes its potential, I think much of the rest of the world can look at South Africa and say, that's the way to do this. Most countries don't have the sophisticated robotic system that you have, okay? But that sophisticated robotic system is not going to, the potential isn't going to be maximized until you pass this law, until you put police in the position of being able to use it in a way that maximizes its potential. So I think that you are ahead of many other countries in that most countries, when they start out databasing, they start out with the law, but they lack the infrastructure, the laboratory infrastructure, to do what they need to do. you are kind of in the opposite position. You're already there. The day that you pass the law, you are going to be able to really begin to move things along in a way that other countries take a lot longer to implement. And the other thing I would say in our senior draft, your draft is, I think, a very solid draft, and you already are beginning to take DNA in the draft. You're already taking DNA from the right people. Oftentimes, years ago, and Madam Chair, you, I think, very wisely mentioned learning from the mistakes of other countries. Many countries started off the wrong way, in that they only took from individuals convicted of serious violence and violent offenses. While it made sense to have them in the database, it didn't make sense that way from an investigative standpoint. Because if you are in jail because you committed a serious violent offense, what are you getting out to then recommit crime? Not for a long time, right? The value of the database comes when the perpetrator is back out on the street committing other crimes. A lot of countries passed laws, put real serious people on their database, and then never solved any cases because the serious people were still in jail. Okay. So again, the current law that you have, I think, is very solid and puts you on a really good path to be very successful. Again, I already mentioned that there's a recognition that backlogs represent lives lost. And I'd appreciate it if you make a little note on your presentation there. I say no legislation is worse than imperfect legislation. And that can be read the wrong way. What I really mean to say is that not having any legislation can be worse than having imperfect legislation. Okay, and I want to make that point clearly because just about every country in the world has also, once it has passed a DNA databasing structural legislation, they've gone back and they changed it. So it's not unusual at all to recognize that one of the things to do is to get started, to empower police to begin to maximize the potential of the legislation, and then if there are issues that arise, make appropriate amendments. If you look at the next page, you can see that there are over 50 countries throughout the world that have already passed DNA databasing legislation. Read that. 50 countries have already struggled through what you're struggling through. 50 countries that have already made plenty of mistakes, and 50 countries that have done plenty of things correctly. And that have really begun to save people's lives because they've empowered their criminal justice agency or their criminal justice system to implement the technology. Every country in Europe has forensic DNA database legislation. One of the reasons for that is because the European Union, and I should be clear with that, every country in the European Union has DNA database legislation. The reason for that is because a number of years ago, the European Union itself made it a requirement that every country in the EU must pass DNA database legislation if they wanted to be part of that. And any country looking for accession into the European Union must have that DNA database and legislation in place. Now, they don't tell them what the legislation needs to be. That's a sovereign issue. And every country's DNA database legislation is different. The fundamentals are pretty much the same. But the fact is that everyone in Europe has to have that legislation in place, ultimately with an eye towards sharing data back and forth between countries, which is so important in Europe, particularly now with European unionization and the ease of travel which occurs between countries. In the United States, not only has the United States passed federal law, but every state in the United States has had to pass its own DNA database legislation. Because in the United States, we consider it to be a sovereign responsibility of the state to pass the law that it feels is most appropriate. There are certain federal guidelines, but ultimately who is included and things like that, that's a state issue. Australia, all states in Australia have also passed their own databasing legislation. And then just some other examples, Canada, Russia, Kenya, Malaysia, are all countries that have struggled with the same issue, and I think have provided lessons for not just for South Africa, but for the rest of the world. On the next slide, that first statement, I think, is one of the most important things that I ever have to say. No country has ever reduced the scope of DNA database testing that is done. And what I mean by that is no country has ever started off with a DNA database and said, we're only going to take from this group of people, let's say, for example, we're only going to take DNA for our reference database from individuals convicted of sexual assault, burglary, homicide, and then gone back and said, you know, this isn't as effective as we thought it would be, or we have a number of problems, so let's do fewer people than we were. No country has ever gone back to do less DNA database testing. They have only ever gone back and increased the scope of databasing that they do. And I think the reason for that is twofold. Number one, just the sheer effectiveness of the database. Most databases increase their effectiveness with the volume of data. I've heard you go through some of those discussions with the fingerprint database and connecting the different databases together. It's the same with DNA. The bigger the database, the more data, the more likely you are to maximize, number one, the potential to solve crime, and number two, maximize the value of your investment dollar in DNA, right? So I think that's the first reason why you see that expansion. But I think just as importantly, the reason that you see that expansion is because of the effectiveness of the safety and security measures built into the system. I cannot count for you one example around the world, and understand, that what I do is I study what goes on in the world in forensic DNA database. That's kind of part of my job. And while I don't pretend to know everything in the world, I can tell you that I don't know of one example where the DNA database has been intentionally misused, manipulated, etc. I can't tell you of any country where they have had to arrest someone or anything like that where the database has been intentionally misused. I can cite for you certain mistakes that have occurred. I can cite for you mistakes in laboratories. But again, this is a system run by human beings, and you're going to have mistakes. But the security systems in place, things like the nature of the code, the regions that we look at your DNA, the criminal penalties for misuse of the database, the database structure itself and what's included and what's not. I think those are all reasons why it has, around the world, been a system that has been very trustworthy and incapable of being manipulated. Do I think that someday I'm going to read a bad story in some country about something that somebody did wrong? Sure. It's a world of human beings out there. But again, I think the point is the security systems are very, very good. The next slide, each country and state has had to address similar issues that arise in the context of forensic databasing, but understand, always in the context of its own cultural, historical, and legal dynamics. Every country's got its own historical differences. Every country has its own cultural differences. But some of the fundamentals are the same. I'll give you one of the best examples that I can count in terms of historical dynamics influencing a database decision, and that's Germany. There are only two countries in the world that I'm aware of that automatically, that encode in their legislation the requirement to destroy the biological sample itself from a reference sample. That's Germany and Belgium. We can probably understand why Germany would feel that keeping biological material around that might ultimately at some other time be able to be tested to identify people and races and things like that. That was a historical and cultural decision. Belgium was kind of the same thing because Belgium had the same impact that Germany had from the Nazi regime. So that's one example where culture and history does play into decisions that are made. And while each databasing legislation is different, there are many issues which, after extensive scientific and legal research, have been addressed in very similar ways. And again, Madam Chair, as you recognize, there is no need to reinvent the wheel on many issues. You might have a... The next... some of the issues include, some of these issues that different countries have looked at. First of all, the creation of forensic DNA sample backlogs. And one of my messages here is, don't be afraid of them. Every country that has ever started DNA databasing has created a DNA sample backlog. It happens, there are ways to deal with it, and we'll talk about that in a minute. Protection of human constitutional and other legal rights, sample and profile retention, and then the type of sample to be collected and who may collect it. That is, in the context of DNA testing, That's a tremendously important issue. So we'll talk about backlogs first. Again, it's a natural part of the forensic DNA integration process. By nature of passing legislation, every country in the world, the day that the legislation got passed and was signed off by whatever the executive is in that country, police are, as of that day, or depending if they phase it in, they're tasked with analyzing a set of DNA that they didn't have to do before, right? They now have a whole class of individuals, whatever that class may be, convicted offenders, arrestees, a whole class as of that day that they are responsible for that they weren't before. In most countries, and again, South Africa is the exception here, but in most countries, they are the laboratory system that they have to implement that was never designed for that kind of volume. It was designed 10 or 20 years ago when they first started doing DNA, and databasing was that volume was never an issue. But again, South Africa is in a much better situation. But the existence of DNA database itself is going to drive your database utilization also. As your law enforcement agency and your individual law enforcement officers begin to see the effects of the DNA database, and they begin to see it as a realistic way to solve crime, and they become more in tune with what its potential is, you will see them begin to utilize it more. The best example of that is in the context of property crime. Right now, and I use the example of the United States, and I try to use the example of the United States in some of the mistakes that have been made. We don't use DNA in property crimes much in the U.S., even though there's been a report from the United States Department of Justice that said, from a cost-benefit analysis, the utilization of DNA in property crimes, i.e. burglaries and car thefts, the cost-benefit analysis of doing DNA instead of fingerprints comes out 3 or 4 times in favor of DNA. Okay. And yet we don't do it that much. Why don't we do it? Well, because of the backlog. And the police philosophy is understandably, well, if it's going to take me a year to get that sample done anyway, what's the point? Why should I even submit it? And you're going to see that as your database becomes more effective, as you begin to reduce your backlog of cases, as your turnaround time, as we call it, the time it takes to get from the crime scene sample through the testing process to a result in the database, as that time becomes smaller, it becomes a more effective investigative tool. If it takes a year, it's not an investigative tool, right? It doesn't help police do anything. They haven't saved any time or money in man hours. They can't stop their other investigations while they wait for DNA. So the key is to get that turnaround time smaller and smaller and smaller so that it truly becomes investigative tool. It's what we don't do well in the United States. It's what they do exceptionally well in the UK. The reason that the United Kingdom is considered the most effective in databasing in the world is this. When I lived in England, I woke up one day, and the headline on the three major papers in London, the Observer, the Independent, and the Times, was essentially the same. And what it spoke about was the scandal, and they call it a scandal, that was the turnaround time for the Forensic Science Service, which was over 30 days. 30 days. I looked at that and said, 30 days? We're lucky in the U.S. if you get 6 months. The FBI won't turn around a case within a year. Right? So the Home Office in the United Kingdom said, no, no, no. You're going to go back to Forensic Science Service and you're going to get turnaround time to 14 days. Or heads are going to roll, as we said. And so that's one of the reasons that the United Kingdom is so effective, that they genuinely use their DNA system to solve crimes up front and to solve them quickly. And solving quickly is towards one goal. One goal is to capture perpetrators so you prevent other crimes. And that's the scandal is that if you don't catch them as soon as you can, they're going to victimize those people. So that turnaround time is incredibly, incredibly important, and a lot of things obviously affect that. But once database is operational and police see the value of it, they will want to use it even more. The answer to that problem, or one of the answers to that problem, around the world, has been the utilization of private laboratories.
Yep.
You cannot do this, particularly in a country this size. You will never reduce that backlog down quickly enough. You will never get that turnaround time quick enough if you don't utilize private laboratories. It's happened in, again, just about every country. And it doesn't have to be a permanent thing. Again, the day you pass the legislation, police have a volume of samples that they didn't have the day before. Right? Most private laboratories were developed with the idea of volume testing. In the United States, for example, we have companies called Bode and Orchid and Myriad Genetics. Well, Myriad Genetics was a cancer testing screen company. So they had the capacity to do things very, very quickly. And when you're only doing, you know, the few number of what we call loci, the little bit of DNA that we're looking at, they can turn that around very quickly. And again, if you're not turning around quickly, people are dying, people are being victimized. And particularly when you've got a large volume of cases, the utilization of private laboratories is really, really important. The United Kingdom uses them all the time. There's LGC, there's Orchid. There are a number of companies in the United Kingdom. Germany actually built into their legislation, they actually approved the certain private laboratories that were approved for doing that kind of testing. Another thing to understand is that any outsourcing screen, and it's probably better to call it contracting of services, because that's really what it is, right? All government agencies contract out services. There's no reason that the police service shouldn't be able to contract out services also. The private laboratories that you contract out to are going to have the same certification, the same accreditation that the public lab does, that the government lab does. I can tell you that I'm not aware of any instances around the world where, by nature of the fact of using private laboratories, the nature, the quality of the work was any less than the government labs. And in fact, I can tell you, it's actually been the opposite, that oftentimes public labs are better than their private labs. The private lab quality is better than public labs. Yeah. I'm not at all suggesting that to be the case in South Africa. Again, I have tremendous respect for the quality of the South African Police Service work. But again, you'll see that in the United States, we spend over $100 million a year on outsourcing samples. And I know that that's an issue here in South Africa. And to me, it's one of the most important. And failure to utilize the advantages of contracting out services to a private lab will cost people's lives, period. Because you won't get things done as quickly as you should, or could, I should say. And that will cost people's lives. People will die because of it. And I know that's a harsh statement. And again, it's a system that has to move at a certain speed because there's a whole lot of moving parts. But ultimately, that is the bottom line. The protection of human constitutional and other legal rights. There has never been a database anywhere in the world that I'm aware of that has been overturned for legal purposes. Those legal purposes, legal reasons, either constitutional or from a human rights standpoint. They've certainly been challenged in every country, you know, and they continue to be challenged in the United States on a regular basis. The nature of what defense attorneys do, God bless them, but there has never been one overturned. The Marfer case is an interesting application, and it's really, really important to understand exactly what the Marfer case said. What the Marfer case addressed was solely the issue of whether or not you could retain the profiles and the samples of individuals who had subsequently been exonerated or not prosecuted. That's it. Marfer never said you cannot take from suspects. It never said you cannot take from arrestees. It never said that. It said if someone is deemed to be innocent or not prosecuted, well, it's not really fair to keep them in the DNA database. And you know the only country in the world that even tried to do that? It's the United Kingdom. It's the only place that it is an issue, or was an issue, it's not anymore. The only place where it was an issue was in the United Kingdom. So it didn't have an impact on any other country's database. Sample and profile retention is another issue that is country specific, obviously. But there's a lot that can be learned. Most countries attach sample destruction to the profile retention. In other words, they keep the samples until such time as the profile is to be removed. I guess legally the profile is to be removed. The allowance there is obvious. Number one, if new technology arises that allows police to do their job better, it's available. Now there's a downside to that by keeping it around. If there is a technology that you don't want police to be using, it's also available for that. And that's kind of the concern. That's the concern about having sample retention, right? The concern is that police might someday want to do something that we don't want them to do with it. Not what they're testing for now and what they're putting in the database. Remember, all that's in the database, there's no DNA in the database, in the DNA database. There's none. There's no DNA in a DNA database. The only thing in a DNA database is an electronic representation of people's DNA. It's a number cruncher. That's all it is. But that sample retention issue is an interesting one. Again, I already talked about Germany and Belgium. They destroy samples. And quite frankly, they're fine with it. There aren't a whole lot of issues in Germany or Belgium where they wish they had retained them. But there are reasons to retain. New technology, number one. I'll give you an example. In the United States, when we first started our database, we started it with a technology called RFLP. I won't go into details, but that's what it was. We got about 250,000 samples into the database when something called PCR came along. PCR was a much quicker process, and it allowed us to do DNA analysis on samples that were much, much, much older. If it weren't for PCR, we wouldn't have all the exonerations that we do. But what we realized was that we needed to change the whole system. We needed to now have a PCR-based database, which meant we had to go back and retest all those 250,000 samples that were already in the system. I don't think that's likely to happen in a fundamental way anytime soon. We can already do so much with so little in terms of identifying people from small biological samples that in speaking to most of the scientists, they don't see a major change, but you never know. There's another reason, though, to retain samples. In the U.S. and in most countries, what happens is when a DNA hit is made in the database, what they do is they go back to the original sample. They DNA test the original sample so that we make sure we haven't made a mistake in the database. So it acts as a confirmatory test. Now, obviously, they don't do that in Germany, and they're fine with it. So I understand that sample destruction is being considered here in relatively short order, and I think that's fine. Profile retention, though, is a different issue. Profile retention is a different issue. The reason that the Marker case ever came up was a logistical decision. The reason that the UK retained profile in their database of individuals who were ultimately exonerated, it really didn't have anything to do with the ability to solve crime with those profiles. It had to do with the logistical difficulty of expunging profiles out of the system. Because what would happen would be, someone would be exonerated or not prosecuted, and their profile would be in the database. Okay? They were supposed to expunge it, but they didn't for a certain amount of time, and let's say, a year later, it's still in the database, they haven't gotten it out yet, and they get a hit to that profile. In other words, they make an identification that this person committed a crime, but the profile wasn't supposed to be in the database. Mm-hmm. So what's the legal status of that investigative lead? What's the legal status of that evidence? So they had a few cases like that, which were kind of a big deal, so the United Kingdom said, well, let's just pass a law that we don't have to take it out. If we don't have to worry about expungement, then there isn't going to be any question about the legal status of that profile, right? Well, that's what the Court of Human Rights in Europe has said. It says, no, you have a responsibility as a government to deal with that. Okay? You've got to deal with that. It's just not good enough that it's too hard to do. You need to come up with a better system. And so I think the lesson there is that when you have that requirement of expungement of the profile, what you have to do is you have to give police time to get it done. It's not a simple process. I know it kind of sounds like it is. Gosh, you should be able to look somebody up and push a button to get it out. It's not that simple. So I think the appropriate way to handle the way most countries have decided to handle it is look at a period of time, 6 months or a year, for police to get that profile out of the database. And quite frankly, if they get a hit before that time, before they're legally required to pull it out of the database, then that's still good evidence. That's still a legitimate hit. no reason not to use that. Okay, but that profile retention issue, you've got to allow police enough time, because if you don't, you are going to create a lot of cases where you're going to have a lot of problems because you are going to get some hits. The United Kingdom solved a lot of cases on the part of their database that was just individuals who were not ultimately convicted. I mean, as we understand, there are a whole lot of reasons why someone is not convicted that have absolutely nothing to do with their actual innocence, right? I mean, a whole lot of reasons why someone might not be. Victims may die, they may disappear, you know, there may be technicalities, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a whole lot of reasons why someone might be in a data, but might be exonerated, but still actually committed that crime. So there is an investigative value to that database also. And then I'll finish up and kind of answer any questions you might have. The type of sample to be collected and who may collect that sample. I know that there are issues about taking blood and buccal swabs and things like that, and whether or not the utilization of registered medical professionals is required. Few things are a bigger use of time and money than the need to use registered medical professionals to draw blood. It is an expensive proposition. It will add more expense to your system than just about anything else. And it's not necessary, quite frankly. Particularly if you're going to do finger pricks. I don't know of a country in the world that requires, number one, blood to be taken. There may be some that require blood. I don't know one that requires medical professionals to do a finger prick. Not one. Understand that what's happened is, over the years, our technology has gotten much better, okay? One of the great things about DNA is that we can do so much more than we could 10 years ago. We used to have to draw blood, venously, to get enough sample to reliably test it. That's not the case anymore. The technology is fundamentally different. You can use a buccal swab, a cheek swab, and get just as good reliable DNA profiles as if you were to take blood at all, particularly blood from your vein. So if you do use a blood-based system, you only need to do a finger stick. You don't need that pile of blood anymore. You only need the small enough amount that comes out of pricking someone's finger, and there is no need whatsoever for a registered medical professional to do that. It's not cost-effective, and quite frankly, it's dangerous. It's dangerous. You can't send nurses, you can't send people who are not trained to deal with people in prison and things like that who don't want their DNA taken. You know, eventually you're going to get a culture here where the criminal population understands there's a database out here that works, and they're going to understand the implications of being in that database. And when someone doesn't want to give a sample, it's not a safe dynamic. So the idea that you would have folks who are medically trained but not necessarily law enforcement trained is a difficult issue. And again, I don't know of any country in the world that requires that blood be taken by a medical professional if it's a finger stick. I'm not talking, obviously, if it's an arm vein intake, then you do require it. But for a finger prick, absolutely not. And again, you don't even need blood for your databasing system. You can use buccal swabs for your databasing system. That's really... That's all I have in terms of kind of formal presentations, but I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Yeah, thank you very much, Mr. Kaplan. For me, the presentation is saying we're correct to split the bill. We're correct to say we'll have to conduct our own comparative study. We're correct to say we have to undertake an international tour to learn from other countries. But probably I think it will be correct for us also to check on what developing countries are doing that are the same as us. Because for sure we cannot compare ourselves that much with developed countries, because we might not afford what developed countries are doing. But I'm not saying we cannot do it. But I'm just saying it for today. We are we have got to go back to where we were, and therefore we will take questions, but by 1:45, definitely must be calling back the lawyer so that we can adopt the bill that is before us. But I will take clarity-seeking questions, and I will request members to please be specific, not ask many questions. Honorable Chafer, Honorable Craig, Honorable Annelies.
Yes, thank you very much. Very, very interesting presentation. I'm looking at the technicalities. Is there anywhere or any development of a thought process that's looking at a global system whereby you ensure, like, does the USA system talk to the UK system, et cetera, et cetera? You know, the world is only this big these days. And to be able to track someone down who's perpetrating crimes in the UK that you know now, it's obviously an Interpol thing, but are the systems talking, and is this something as a country we should be looking at? I don't know. Is there such a thing as sort of global best practice in these sort of databases?
Yes. Please. The first time that I ever came to South Africa was actually...
Let's take all questions so that you respond one, because I think it's going to take long.
Okay, very well.
No, I just would like some clarity. I mean, you're saying that some countries destroy and then others don't, but then I understand that they don't all, you know, that don't all keep them. So I'm not quite sure what you're saying. Do they keep them or don't they keep them? If so, for how long? Is there legislation in other countries that allows you to keep DNA for a specific time period? And is it generally only a criminal database that you keep the DNA profile of? People have been convicted of crime.
Yes, Craig.
Thanks, Chairperson. So just to say thanks very much for the presentation. I'm sure it's information that we'll be able to look at when we come to actually dealing with the legislation. It's always helpful. I think what I wanted to find out is, in terms of you spent quite a bit of time emphasizing the use of private laboratories. You were saying, my institution, you're saying that if you use a private laboratory for use, there's a faster turnaround than if you use public laboratories. But I'd like to ask, I mean, in terms of countries that primarily focus on using public laboratories, what's the turnaround time? Is it a lot slower? Is it a lot faster? I'd just like to know, and I'd like to get an idea of some of those countries that actually use public laboratories.
Public or private?
Just one other question. You don't really, in terms of the countries here, you mentioned past legislation. There's only one country in Africa. You talk about Kenya. Don't talk about too many developing countries. Can you give us some examples of other developing countries that would be good to look at? I'll stop there.
I think at the moment, just a question around DNA evidence as part of proper investigation and not as just medical solution, and how did other countries go about in terms of training regarding this issue, also in terms of the prosecutors and your judges for that matter. We all know that defense attorneys are more often than not very good. We've got one here. Seem to be very good, and therefore for me there's the whole issue about one being careful to see this as a medical solution to your crime problems and not lacking what is necessary in terms of proper investigation to complement your DNA evidence becomes important, and what was done about training in that regard.
I also yet to say the information that you gather has nothing to do with what a person is, you know, like your illnesses and so on. But what about inherited information? How do you deal with it?
Yeah.
What about inherited information? The fact that, despite its reliability, as you have said, but it will still be, it depends on human being intervention. So its reliability depends on what people do.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. I'm just saying that.
As the people who are trained to utilize it, and that's the police, that's the prosecutor, that's the laboratory, you're exactly right.
In fact, the members will know I'm about to say I have a neighbor whose child is a replica of the father, a replica. Comes in here, he's the father. If you've seen him on the road and you see the father, you know he's the son. But the DNA results are saying he's not the father.
Mm-hmm.
That's the question I will always ask on the reliability of these things, and I'm saying they depend on what people do sometimes. I'm just saying, thank you, but let's hear you. And I'm afraid we're running out of time.
I'll move as quickly as I can. The international sharing issue. Yeah, those issues are all addressed, and I can tell you that the South African Police Service is probably well prepared to deal with that. These databases are based on a certain software, and there are a number of different kinds of software, but Interpol does have what they call the Interpol DNA Gateway, and that accommodates all the different software. You'll hear the word CODIS a lot. CODIS is the Combined DNA Indexing System. It is the software that the U.S. and many other countries use. But the software is what allows that sharing when countries give other countries permission to do so. That whole year, there is a European Union-wide sharing of data that now goes on because of that exact issue. You could be a convicted offender in the database in the UK, get out of jail, drive across to Germany and start molesting children there, and would never be able to catch it. Well, that's not going to happen anymore because they recognize the value of that sharing. So those systems are in place, but you got to have your own database law and everything else in place. But yeah, that the world is looking to that. There's also a G8 component to that also. So those issues exist. In terms of who keeps what and who doesn't, in terms of, now remember when we're talking about keeping, we're always talking about two separate things. We're talking about the keeping of the profile of the system, or we're talking about the keeping of the biological sample itself. Two countries destroy the biological sample as soon as a verifiable profile is developed. That's Germany and Belgium. Just about everybody else maintains that biological sample itself in some storage facility. And it's usually just a little card, it's a little piece of paper. They keep that in some storage facility until such time as the profile, right, the profile is legally has to be taken out of the system. Then they take this out, then they go over, and then they destroy the sample. Okay. So again, there's really only two countries that I'm aware of that require relative immediate destruction of the biological sample. Honestly, I'm surprised that more don't require it. I'm surprised that more countries, just to kind of get rid of the question of, well, what if something bad happens to it? Just to get rid of it, I'm surprised that more countries don't, but they don't. Private labs and the speed at which they move compared to the public labs. It's a hard question to answer because it's very, very country specific. It's country specific in two areas. Number one is, well, how big is your country and what's your volume of crime look like? I'll give you an example. Japan is a big country, but they don't have a whole lot of crime. They have some, but they don't have a whole lot. So they don't have a big backlog. Okay. But there are countries, and it's always a relationship. And it's always using the contract services to complement whatever the public lab is doing. That's the way the United States works. Every state in the United States has its own state laboratory, and they do plenty of work. But what they do is they supplement that by using the private lab for outsourcing. Usually, what you're using it for, not exclusively, is you're using your public lab for the actual crime scene work. Because crime scene work is more time consuming, more expensive. That's going to the crime scene, getting the evidence, finding the blood on the floor, finding the saliva on the beer bottle, taking that and processing it that way. That's what you want your police lab doing the most of, and that's the way they do it here. Your laboratory, your robotic system is designed to do that. What they want the private laboratory system to do is the simple stuff. It's just the buckle swab that you can process 100 at a time. Because that's all you're doing is processing a buckle swab. You're not doing the hard work of finding, where is
where is the semen on this the blanket or that kind of thing? So, you know, most every country that's going to is going to have its own public laboratory system. So any of the ones, to answer your question, what should you look at in terms of public lab? Any number of countries will have their own public laboratory system. For example, in France, I think one, the gendarme does one, and the police do the other in terms of the database, and I forget which is which, but I think maybe the gendarme does the actual database more. And Canada is a really good example to look at in terms of a high throughput system too. Their public lab is very good at high throughput testing. And in terms of other developing countries, I'll tell you right now that the Kenyan databasing law is not a good law at all. Very short, doesn't put off, and they have no money for their laboratory. But more importantly, they are one of the countries that I mentioned. They only take from convicted offenders of serious violent offenses like sex crimes and burglaries. So they're not going to have an effective databasing system, but they don't have the laboratory capacity to do anything anyway. So that's not an issue. In terms of other countries, I think Malaysia just passed their databasing law. Colombia has a very sophisticated laboratory system that's good to look at because of the impact that Colombia has on the United States in terms of drug trafficking and things like that. We have poured billions of dollars into Colombia for the purpose of developing their own criminal justice system and laboratory. The training issue and from both a prosecutorial perspective and a law enforcement perspective, there's two things to understand about training police officers. Number one, we've done studies in the United States in terms of the effectiveness of having DNA from a crime scene taken by expert crime scene analysts and or just first responding patrol officers. And what we found was that there is no difference in the quality of DNA results that come when first responding officers take it. Shocked me too, but it's really, really important. Because what it means is that you don't need to put the kind of investment in what they call SOCOs in the UK to do that. Now, I understand that there are different overall levels of training for law enforcement agencies in different countries. And my guess is that in the United States, we're able to put more resources in the general training of our first responding law enforcement officers than a lot of other countries are. And that may be why our first responding law enforcement officers can be as effective as they are. So you may need to pay more attention to that in South Africa, depending upon what training looks like in general. You know, in the United States, you go through about a month-long training program to become a police officer, about 2 or 3 hours of which has to do with forensic science. A lot of countries don't even do that much to their patrol officers. But the important point is, collecting DNA from a crime scene isn't brain surgery. It's not what it appears to be necessarily on CSI, if you have CSI in South Africa. Now, that's not to say that there aren't certain crimes. I mean, there are certain crime scenes where everybody goes, we get how important this is, and so we're going to bring in the experts and everything. That dynamic happens also. But the second issue about training your police officers is this. You also have to train them what not to take. What you can't do is you can't train your law enforcement agencies that what they want to do is they want to go and they want to get all the DNA they can out of their crime scene. That will grind your laboratory system to a screeching halt, and it will mean that you will be collecting evidence that is not relevant to your case, and if it's not relevant to your case, it's detrimental to your case. You can collect crime scene samples, and I say this advisedly, recognizing you have a defense attorney in the room. If you collect samples, right, and I mean, think about this from a defense standpoint, right? You collect samples that don't belong to the perpetrator or anybody else that you can identify because your police didn't correct samples well. They didn't look at probative samples. They just took everything. Well, what's that then become? Well, it becomes your defense. I don't know who killed this person. I don't know who did this crime. I know it wasn't my client, and I know that their DNA profile looks like this. It's not my fault that the police don't know who this profile belongs to. And that may happen just because police take too much from a crime scene when they shouldn't. Remember, we can take DNA from a piece of evidence that we can't even see. So that's a part of the training process. So I think it's a very correct and legitimate observation to say that training is a necessary component to which you need to pay a lot of attention. And I give you a lot of credit because I know it's addressed in the bill. And I think that's a wise decision. And then just finally, Madam Chair, you talked about the inherited aspect of DNA. In terms of all of our DNA is obviously inherited. So necessarily, the DNA that we look at in this criminal justice context is inherited from our parents. That doesn't mean that we can tell anything about your parents based on your DNA or anything like that. Okay? If you have inherited a certain disease from your parents, like Huntington's disease or something like that, there's no way to look at that. There's no way to determine anything of that in the DNA profile that we look at. You just can't. The 13th loci that we look at in the United States, there's no way to look at any of those and say they have a predisposition to this genetically inherited trait. It just can't happen. It just doesn't work. Okay? And I will simply respectfully say that there have been a number of cases where the perpetrator in a case looks exactly like the person who was accused of it, who didn't commit the crime. And so the fact that somebody looks like somebody else, and in the child-father relationship that you mentioned, statistically, scientifically, the DNA says that they're not the father. That's the case. And here's why. You're not going to get a false positive, as we say. You might get a false negative. It's much easier to get it wrong in terms of not identifying a perpetrator. The big concern from law enforcement is really, are we missing somebody that we should get, not do we have someone that we shouldn't have already? Okay. So in terms of DNA testing, because it is so specific, and because when we talk about the likelihood of someone being related to someone else, we talk about it in the millions of billions, right? This person, this DNA sample, the likelihood that this DNA sample came from someone other than this person over here is 1 in 3 billion or 6 trillion. Ultimately, half the world's population. The likelihood that you're going to get it wrong like that is very, 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 very tiny. So normally, particularly in paternity testing, because they look at so much of the DNA, the paternity tests are usually right.
Yeah. Thank you very much. I wish we had time.
Mm-hmm. Well, no, thank you. And again, the secretary has my contact information. If anyone has any questions, I'm always more than happy to help out.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Like I'm saying, I wish we had more time, we would ask more questions. But thank you for your time, and thank you for the presentation. Thank you for responding to our questions. I think, as Honorable Craig indicated, this information will assist us when we deal with the DNA aspect of the bill. And indeed, as a portfolio committee, we acknowledge the fact that this is yet another ammunition for fighting crime. And it is important that we have it processed, but we would want to do a perfect job, as indicated on your presentation. Yes, thank you very much, and we will therefore go back to where we were, and now we will be going to, you are free to leave or to stay, it's up to you, sir. We go back to the bill. We will start from page 1 so that at the end of it all we can then vote and where there are amendments will then deal with amendments at that time. No, I want my old one. Members, we are on page 2, probably starting with the title of the bill is Criminal Law Forensic Procedures Amendment Bill. We agree with this. We're going to page 2 on the long definition. I think we don't have problems with that. Are we in agreement?
Yes.
Then we're going to page 3. We don't have problems with that. We're going to page 4. Authorized person body prints comparative search. We said we're deleting that last portion. And as such, I think it has been deleted. Are we in agreement with that? Yes. Okay, we're going to page 5. We will therefore allow the legal people to lead us there on section C, 36A, 2C.
Okay, we actually started on page 4 because we have inserted now the definition of authorized person.
Can I go to
who is 16 years or older, or caregiver of the child, which includes any person other than a parent or guardian, who factually cares for a child, including a foster parent, person who cares for a child, which implies or express consent of the guardian of the child, a person who cares for a child while the child is intentionally state care, a person at the head of a child in the youth center where a child has been placed, a person at the head of the shelter, a child and youth care worker who cares for a child with without appropriate family care in the community, and 7, a child at the head of the child who is in the home, if such child is 16 years old.
Yes, in the arrangement to do this, we, in top paragraph 2, a person who cares for a child will be implied or expressed consent of the guardian of the child. It should be of the parent or guardian.
Come again.
In subparagraph 2, Roman numeral 2.
Yes.
Then
you switch on your mic.
Not working now.
The next one?
It was on. Maybe you will talk on.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Yeah,
try again. Okay.
Thank you, Jerry. If you look at
you
Roman numeral.
Yes, mic. Thank you. Yeah.
If you look at Roman numeral 2, it says a person who cares for a child with the implied or expressed consent of the guardian of the child. All that I'm saying is in the hurry, we forgot the word parent. It should be parent or guardian of the child. So if it's with the expressed consent of the implied or expressed consent of the parent or guardian, it should be possible. Thank you.
Yeah. In your hurry, you also left out social worker.
Sorry, the social worker is added to the text in the substitute.
Okay. Commissioner Heldeney, can you read section 2 now? Because we have structured it.
Okay, Chair, it reads now. A person who cares for a child will be implied or expressed consent of the parent or guardian of the child.
Okay. So that is 36A1. A person who cares for a child will be implied or expressed consent of the parent or guardian of the child. Okay? Members? That is the definition now of an appropriate person. Are we in agreement? Okay. Of course, there will be change in the numbering of cages now because of the insertion of this definition, but I think we'll still use the original page that are here, okay? And then that is page 4, page 5.
We are just simplifying our definition of curfews. If you read the first part of the definition, and we just want to make, maybe just consider just an alternative. We maybe could just read the word in the first line of the definition of curfews, including up until child, comma. And through that as a subcategory. Because then it will put into a from a doctrine point of view, maybe read better. So now read an appropriate person means any member of the child, child's family, which includes any person other than a parent or guardian who actually cares for a child. Then we have all the categories, Roman 1-7, and then we just include the child, a sibling, or a child who is 16 years older, or caregiver of the child. So that's a thing that reads better.
You are saying we must say appropriate person means any member of a child's family, which includes any person other than a parent or guardian who specially cares for a child, including. That's what you're saying. Yes.
I have a problem with that because it means saying that means that all these persons from 1-7 must be family members.
Come up, construct it now so that we know what you're saying.
We are defining appropriate person who is a member of a child's family, and then we say, which includes any person other than the parent or guardian, so we're extending beyond parent or guardian to include the following person. So we're extending the limit. What we're saying, set the sibling of 16 years of caregiver and put it under the list because you extend it to include the other person.
Yes,
that's
the vision.
From the way that I've read this provision, to understand that Roman numerals 1-7 only have reference to a caregiver. I never read it as defining member of the child's family. So in that sense, I do agree that there might be a problem.
I don't think we can put the sibling in because the sibling may not be a caregiver. They may simply live with that person, but the child may prefer that person, the sibling, to be with them during this experience. So I don't think it's appropriate to move the sibling down into the number.
Okay, I think there is another suggestion. An appropriate person means any member of the child's family or a caregiver of the child, which includes any person other than a parent or guardian who sexually cares for a child, including, or a caregiver of the child. include that. And delete, including a sibling who is 16 years or older.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yes? Commissioner Helen Lee?
Yes, but then it means that any member of the child's family, and there's no age restriction.
No, that's not our understanding. Because if we do that, the 16 years or older, 13, 16 years or older, must then be read, let's say it becomes number 8, must then be read with actually cared for a child. So that's your child in a household. So it can't be any person that he feels he's not going to get in trouble with because this person is 16 years or older, but he's still a child. And therefore, I'm including him. That child must be that 16 years or older, will then be the person that actually takes care of the child. And that is what I thought that we try to get. So I think that way, the way that Nadia, the non-lawyer, has phrased it, is actually now the correct way. It makes sense.
I agree with the non-lawyer, but I think, Director Kellner's point, in any case, it would have meant that anyway, even if it's like a caller. So should we not put in there, an appropriate person means any adult member of a child's family, and then add the 16-year-old thing as it is supported. So you say, so only adult members of the family can be there, and the following people.
Yes.
Yeah,
but
the non-lawyer agrees with
me. Okay. I think we have to... Let's see what is being written now, because we have to agree.
Well,
appropriate person means any member of a child's family.
Any adult member. Can't be a 3-year-old. Must be adult.
I think if we rewrite it now, as Nadia suggested, with the adding of the word adult, the appropriate person means any adult member of a child's family
or
a caregiver of the child, which includes any person other than a parent or a guardian who actually cares for a child, including then the 7th, and then the 8th one would be a sibling who is 16 years or older, because then it's read with that person is the caretaker of the child.
Can I ask, what is wrong with this statement as it is now?
Doesn't
it? An appropriate person means any member of the child's family,
the child,
including a sibling who is 16 years or older, or a caregiver of the child, which includes any person other than a parent or guardian who sexually cares for a child, including. What is wrong with that?
If they're not the child's family.
Yeah, if I may say, what that sentence actually means is that any member of the child's family, including a 3-year-old, is included, including a sibling who is 16 years or older. So it has to say adult.
Adult member of the family.
Including a sibling who is 16 over, and the rest could stand. I mean, I don't know.
No.
But they hate it.
Okay. You can't say including, because you're saying any member of a child's family, including is including that. I mean, it's not including. A caregiver is not necessarily a child's family, and that's what she's supposed to be distinguishing between a family member and a caregiver who is not a family. So in that sense, I agree with Nadia, we should have all a caregiver.
Okay. Now let's read this. Yakon? I feel pity for you, but I still have to want you to speak.
And Chair, the appropriate person means any adult member of child's family, which includes including a sibling. And Appropriate person means any adult member of the child's family, comma, or a caregiver of the child, comma, which includes any person other than a parent or guardian who factually cares for a child, comma, including one, a foster parent, two, the person who cares for a child with implied or express consent of the parent or guardian of the child, semi, three, a person who cares for a child while the child is in temporary safe care, four, the person at the head of the child and youth care center where a child has been placed, five, the person at the head of the shelter. A place shelter would probably be more appropriate here. Six, a child and youth care worker, comma, who cares for a child who is without appropriate family care in the community. And seven, a child at the head of a child in his household, comma, if such a child is 16 years or older.
We're taking that. We're taking that. We're moving to page 5. Okay, we're done with that. Page 5. Page 6. Page 7. We are in agreement. Yes.
But we're not going to include something about tampering there in the bottom section.
Section 3.
The suggestion I thought that we agreed on was a separate subsection that would deal with all of those. That would include tampering, etc.
They've got it on their page 3.
Page 8. Fingerprint and body prints for investigation purposes, section 36C1. any question, any comment?
Can I just ask? Could I just ask, just in case I've missed it, if someone is found innocent in a trial, and that means they then have to destroy their fingerprints, but at the same time, once that trial is over, they're actually facing charges under another for another action. Can you keep the original fingerprints on the database, or do you have to take them fresh and reinsert them? I'm not sure what the situation would be.
Chair, if it turns out the act, the fingerprints have been deleted, the person commits another thing, then it will mean that he's not on the fingerprints on the database. You will have to take the fingerprints. And of course, then you will also not get a hit. In terms of, say for instance, a person is found not guilty, the fingerprints are removed in terms of the act after the police has been notified. Then you find that person's fingerprints on a crime sheet. It means that if you search the database, you won't find the police on that fingerprint.
Okay. And then that is chapter 60. Page 10 of that. No amendments, page 11, we have agreed with that. 12. 13, if there is anything which members feel and they think it's untoward, they will raise their hand. 13. 14. There's no hand, I take it we are green. 15. 16. 17. The manipulation. Okay. 18.
Okay, they have added in, just to point out here, there is a section here on their page 3 that falls in here on page 16, the clause 3D, which they seem to be replacing with this section.
Yes?
Am I right?
So, Madam Chair, what we propose is that everywhere where the tampering is in the Criminal Procedure Act, that we propose, what is on page 3 in the top there, as any person usual allows the use of any fingerprint for purposes that's not relation to detection of crime, etc. Tamper or manipulate the process, falsely claiming it to have been taken from a specific person, or claiming it to have been taken from another person, and then it is. In the Files Control Act, it is specifically placed in the subsection 3 and 7 when we come to that part of the top manager.
Okay.
Now I'm happy. Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Four tampers, four false, yeah. Okay.
Read that now. I want to be sure. Yeah.
Any person who uses or allows the use of any fingerprint as person in the section for any purpose that is not related to the detection of crime, the investigation of an offense, the identification of missing persons, the identification of unidentified human remains, or the conduct of prosecution, and then they will become another one, or any person who tampers or manipulates the process, or any person who falsely claims to have been taken from a specific person's grasp, knowing that it should have been taken from another person's grasp, which is guilty of an offense. So we just need to rephrase that.
I think the commissioner, I can remember, comment, I mean, was much simpler. He's just saying any person who, the colon, then that uses goes into point one. So from users to the end of the section is part of point one. So it'll be any person who uses data or two tampers or manipulates.
Because we want to adopt something we know.
Yeah.
Can you now read it? Particularly Ramifica 2.
Thank you, Chairperson. Any person
will run into the one visit and will allow to use of any fingerprint as a third conversation, or run into the two, after the ticket, for any purpose that is not related to the description of crime, the investigation of an offense, the identification of missing persons, the identification of unidentified human remains, or the conducting of the prosecution. They run into the two, or tampered or manipulated purpose, or run into the three, falsely claimed to have been as taken from a specific person, while knowing it to have.
I don't think it is saying what we want it to say. I think all these Roman figure 1, 2, 3, they are talking to fingerprints that are not properly used. Now, the moment you number uses or who allows the use of fingerprints as Roman figure 1, it means any person who, for any purpose, any person who tampers or manipulates the process. But I think all that is related to fingerprints. I thought so. And it's just that it if you say any person who uses or who allows the use of any fingerprints is referred to in this section, then you say tampers or manipulates the process. Again, it doesn't read properly.
Can I make another
statement? Please. I think we need English now.
Let's leave it as it is. Any person who uses or allows the use of any fingerprints or photographic image as referred to in this section, one, for any purpose, and that whole sentence scans well, or who tampers or manipulates the process, or who falsely claims it to have been taken from a specific person, yada, yada, yada. And I think that solves the problem. Yes?
What about
policy? As a matter of fact, I think this is correct. Any person who uses or who allows the use of any fingerprints as referred to in this section for any purpose
or to tamper
for tampering or manipulating the process
or who falsely claims
is it not better that way? For tampering or manipulating the process
or who tampers.
You want to ask?
Yeah.
I don't think it's false because then they've got the initial column of the tamper, manipulate, that's not related to, it doesn't make sense how it's written, which is how the discussion started. So how about any person who, comma, with regard to fingerprints, body prints, and photographic images, as referred to in this section, comma, Roman numeral 1. For any purpose that's not related, and da da da, because then you cover the finger, your concern about having the fingerprints and body prints related to 2 and 3. Can I pass? Should I say again? Any person who, comma, with regard to fingerprints, body prints, and photographic images as referred to in this section, I don't know if they are, but anyway, comma, who, Roman numeral 1. Uses or who allows the use of those fingerprints as a sex for any purpose, da 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 da, or Roman numeral 2, tampers or manipulates this process, or 3, falsely claims it to have been taken from a specific person, is guilty of the offense.
Yeah, that would do it.
Any person who, comma, with regard to fingerprints, body prints, photographic images, continue.
As referred to in this section.
Who? For any purpose that
Roman
is
one.
Yes, for any purpose not related to the detection of crime.
No. Uses or who allows the use of these fingerprints
takes, no, uses or who allows the use.
For any purpose, not.
For any purpose that is not. Yeah, either that or you can leave it out totally.
Yeah.
Any person, yeah. Any person who.
I'm just concerned about the process. Is that the correct word to use then? I mean, we're not only worried about them tampering or manipulating the process, we're also worried about them manipulating the actual print. I mean, would that be covered by photos? Is process sufficient to cover manipulating the actual print?
Commissioner Dekos?
Well, I think the last one, the falsely claiming it to have been taken from a specific person, that doesn't relate to the manipulate. That is really sort of, plant the fingerprint on the sheet. The manipulation is if you take an existing fingerprint and you change it, you change the fingerprint.
I think to just address that concern, we can say tampers from an investigator process or print.
Yeah,
or images. Yeah. Or manipulate the process, print, or images.
Yeah.
Can we read now this section? I don't know what, but can we read it? Can somebody read it? I sympathize with you, Mr. Jacobs, but I think I still have to. Oh, Delang? Mr. Delang?
I would suggest that you don't say that section. Please go to this chapter and you cover all the others.
Yeah, that's clear.
Can you then read this section? Can you read them, sir?
Any person who, with regard to fingerprints, body prints, or photographic images, uses who allows the use of
fingerprints
in this chapter, for any purpose that's not related to detection of crime, investigation of an offense, the identification of visitors, identification of unidentified human remains, or the conducting of prosecution, and then tampers or manipulate the process or the print or images. And lastly, falsely claiming the fingerprint, body print, or photographic images that have been taken from a specific person whilst knowing it could have been taken from another person. So,
we are agreeing with that.
Yes.
Take your advisor. Please switch off your. Take your advisor. Are you in agreement? So what we are saying is that it's going to say any person who, with regard to fingerprints, body prints, photographic images, as referred to in this chapter, who for any purpose that is not related to the detection of crimes, investigation of an offense, the identification of missing persons, the identification of unidentified human remains, or the conducting of a prosecution, or tempers or manipulate the process or print or images, falsely claiming to have been taken.
Or who falsely claims.
Falsely
claims. Or who. That's the or who. Mm-hmm.
Falsely claim
it to have been taken. And then it runs
a it
yeah.
To have been taken from a specific person whilst knowing it to have been taken from another person. Also, is guilty of an offense and liable on conviction to imprisonment for a period not exceeding 15 years.
Yes.
Number one.
Yeah.
libel on conviction. Yes? Right. Yeah, we have it. Thank you very much. Yeah.
Well, I'll come to you in the ERO. Just to go with Commissioner Jacob's last goal of three, where this identity is very small to claim such prints or images to be, they are taken from a specific ground without knowing it to have been taken. But just that we say it there, because the each becomes too much.
So come again, Annelise, you're saying false claim?
Such images, prints or images.
So falsely claim?
Yeah. Such prints
or images
to be taken from a specific person, mm-hmm. while knowing
them
to have been taken from another person.
Yeah. Okay. Can we continue? And let me please request that before we finally adopt, this is reread to us so that we fully agree with this, because I think now it's just full. Okay? Page 24, okay? No. Okay. Page 16, okay? Page 17, page 18, Mr. Tilanga, can you please writing this section properly so that after this we come back, you read it correctly to us that we can adopt it. Yes, page 19, page 20, page 21, page 22. Page 23, page 24, page section 15A there.
15A would then be the same as true.
Yes?
Just observe, if we now change that first one to chapters, do we need to then be specific about these ones again? Because we're not referring to the section anymore, we're referring to the chapter. So what I'm asking is, do we have to repeat it there again?
Okay. So as soon as we get that one correct, this
so
one will be corrected, okay?
Page 2, that one.
Okay. Okay. 25. Page 26.
Can I just go back? It's just at 15A2 that it wants to replace. It's just right, but it's actually 6. Am I right? The piece that they gave us. Now they want to replace page 24 to section 15A2. 15A2 doesn't say that. It is 15A6. Okay,
so this thing is wrong, right? Yes,
it's
6. Okay. This one here goes up. It's 6. Yeah. Okay? Okay. Page 26. Okay, it's the same
chain.
Okay. 26.
Where is it?
No, there's nothing. There's no 7.
What
Section 6. That must come out. That's
where it says on page 26, just cross it out from there and the next page. It's not, there's a mistake.
Okay. So are we going to have subsection 7? No.
No.
Okay. Okay. Page 26. On page 27, subsection 4 of 15D. Okay, page 27, we don't have any problem.
Yes, 27 is
okay. Yes. On of this one here. And then we're going to page 28, subsection 415C. That is where we are now. The National Commissioner and Director General, can you please present the term?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The National Commissioner, the Director General of the Department of Transport, Aerospace and Correctional Services, must, under the chairpersonship of the National Commissioner, within 6 months of the commencement of the section, develop standard operating procedures, etc. So we have inserted there under the chairpersonship of the National Commissioner.
That's fine. That's all we want. Are we in agreement? Honorable Popimochu, are you in agreement? Yeah. I'm asking, are you agreeing with the section? Okay, we agree. Section 29. I mean, page 429. We are agreeing.
Yeah.
Page 30. Mm-hmm. We are agreeing.
Mm-hmm.
31. 32, 33, deleting the irrespective, I think, 34, 35, 36. Mr. Delan, your turn. Now you must prove to us that in the that is page 36. Okay.
Okay. And would be with you paragraph B, the paragraph B. Be ready to hear, I'll read it.
Yes.
What I've seen here is any person who come up. With regard to any fingerprints, comma, body prints or photographic images referred to in this chapter, M dash, Roman numeral 1, users who are allowed the use of back fingerprints, comma, body prints or images for any purpose that is not related to the detection of crime, comma, or investigation of an offense, comma, the identification of missing persons, comma, the identification of human remains, or the conducting of a prosecution, semicolon, or. Two, tampers with or manipulates the process, or the fingerprints, comma, body prints, or images in question, semicolon, or, Roman three. Falsely claims such fingerprints, comma, body prints, or images to have been taken from a specific person, while knowing them to have been taken from another person or source, comma, is guilty of an offense and liable on conviction to imprisonment for a period not exceeding 15 years.
Yes.
Identification of human remains. I've got it under one, number one.
Yeah. Unidentified.
I'm sorry,
just the word unidentified. So we are agreeing with the version now?
Yes.
Okay. Members?
Are we done? I can't believe it.
We are done. Mr. Jacob, do you have anything you want to do before? You want to say? Okay. To provide for the treating of fingerprints and body prints for investigative purposes. To further provide for the retention of fingerprints and body prints taken under the S. To further regulate the destruction of fingerprints taken under the S. To further regulate proof of certain facts by affidavit or certificate, to amend the South African Police Service Act 1995 so as to regulate the storing and use of fingerprints, body prints, and photographic images of certain categories of persons, to provide for the keeping of database and to allow for comparative searches against those databases, to provide for security measures relating to the integrity of information stored on these databases, to make provision for the development of standing operating procedures regarding access to the databases of other state departments, to amend the Firearms Control Act 200 so as to further regulate the powers in respect of fingerprints and body prints, to amend the Explosives Act 203 so as to further regulate the powers in respect of fingerprints and body prints for investigation purposes, and to provide for matters connected therewith. The report of the committee on the same bill, the report of the Portfolio Committee on Police and Criminal Law Forensic Procedures Amendment Bill, B2 2009, National Assembly Section 75, dated 23 March 2010, the Portfolio Committee on Police, having considered the subject of the Criminal Law Forensic Procedures Amendment Bill, B9 2009, referred to it and classified by the joint taking mechanism as a Section 75 bill, present a redraft of the bill B9B 2009, and this report is to be considered. I think after this we will then vote in support or against the bill. I want to mention the fact that the Honorable Dovu of ISP, Honorable Reverend Mishwe of FCDP, Honorable Lule George of COPE indicated to the chairperson that they will vote in support of the bill even if they are not in the meeting, as I indicated earlier on, they have our commitment. And we are at a stage where we have to vote either for or against the bill. And I will therefore take a hand that will either support or not support the bill. Honorable,
I'd like to propose, well, I'm sort of speaking, I'm speaking to the board of the law, and I'd like to propose that the portfolio committee adopt the law together with the amendment that will be discussed today. Thank you.
The Honorable Craig Mann has moved that the bill be supported. And second, Honorable Chief. Are you supporting?
Not sure. A bit nervously. I have absolutely no problem with the bill, and I think we've done justification to it. I'm nervous about the implementation, because I mean, going through looking at SAT, looking for 1.5 billion to complete the rollout of the fingerprint enrollment system, and then another 1.3 billion to upgrade, and the other correctional services, and they haven't even asked for budget to implement it. So while it's fine to pass it, but it's going to be a very long time before even we reach kindergarten in implementing it. Just my little charming, cheerful word of warning.
Yes, listen, I think we, the DOE has seconded the bill. I think there's going to be challenges, but I think we must be positive as well. There's an existing database, and what this bill does, it gives companies the ability to access those databases and do comparison studies.
Yeah.
And I think in that way, it will go a long way in contributing to identifying trafficking quicker and to get the wheels of justice turning faster as well. So,
we therefore can, without any fear of contradiction, say that the committee has adopted the bill. I wanted the stage. I wanted the stage to say to the meeting, I think this is yet another milestone that we have reached as this portfolio committee in actually doing it possible for our SACs to fight crime in a manner that is effective. Surely there will be some teething problems or challenges in the implementation of the bill, but I think those will outweigh the work and the effect of this bill. I want to take this opportunity to thank first the lawyers. Doesn't matter that they never agree, but this time they have had to agree. To thank them for the work that they have done, the state law advisors who fitted the bill for us, the lawyer from the Department of Justice, of course, from the Department of Police, for their hard work. Sometimes I sit here and realize that, you know, members of parliament, I know them, they can be difficult and they will still continue with us, because our aim is to pass a law that is of quality, and I think you've managed to assist us in that. When we do that, surely many of us are not lawyers by profession, so we have this thing in our mind, but sometimes we can't put it in writing in the language that is legally acceptable, and we thank you very much for that. Really, I'm saying it from my heart. Thank you very, very much for that. But I also want to thank the members of the Portfolio Committee. You know, when we had to leave earlier last year, remember, we came back here, and at the time we were very exhausted, but all of them came back as per the request of the chairperson. That cannot go unnoticed, and it can't be proper that the chairperson will not acknowledge that, and thank you for that. I want to thank the support staff for preparing documents and ensuring that these meetings sit, and ensuring that we're able to deliberate on this important piece of legislation. Thank you, all of you. Thank you, the media people or any other person who has interest in this talk, who kept on coming to hear what we are doing and what we are saying. Today, it will be once we pass this bill into an act, it will be possible for police to take fingerprints and immediately compare them with the fingerprints that are already there, not to wait for in case a person is arrested. And if not arrested, they will keep those fingerprints, they are not able to compare them. I want to thank you very much for that. And this meeting of today, and let me tell you, for me, it's the first day. Because this is the first bill that we are adopting as a portfolio committee, with me being the chairperson. And it's an experience that I've learned, not easy, but I had to learn it. And thank you, made it possible for me to learn. Thank you very much. And this meeting is indeed closed. There is a hand before I close. I normally don't allow it.
She just closed the meeting. She knows where.
She knows about. Yeah, I have a problem with the bill, but one of the things that we passed in the bill today talks about the fact that there needs to be standard operating procedures that need to be adopted within 6 months, relative to 6 months. And I know that this year is a hard year in terms of the program of Parliament, but I do think we need to note that it needs to be placed on record that within the capacity to end of these 6 months, once the bill comes into effect, we do need to call the department for us
and
brief them on how they intend to implement this. Because I think it would be wrong for us to make it possible. Asking if it can be included sometime in the program, obviously once the bill comes in.
Definitely we will do that. Thank you very much for meeting the floor.
Thank you.